Okay, everybody, we'll call this committee meeting to order for the ad hoc committee to review the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor. Angela, could you take roll, please?
Chair Dubrava.
Here.
Vice Chair Perkins.
Here.
Regent Brooks.
Here.
Regent Carter.
Present.
Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Geddes.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Thank you. We will go to item one, public comment. Is there any public comment in Reno?
There is.
Amy Payson, AMY PASON, past chair of the Faculty Senate Council of Chairs, speaking on behalf of myself with the experience of working with the chancellors and board over the last 3 years. Before deciding on the role of the chancellor, I believe it's important to remind the board of their own role in shared governance systems. The AUP statement on the government of colleges and universities is clear on the limited role of governing boards such as the Board of Regents, emphasizing always that faculty are the drivers of the academic mission, including curriculum, research, faculty appointments, including promotion and tenure. Faculty work jointly with presidents and the board on budgeting, operations, and policies, as it is faculty and staff that are responsible for implementing policies and programming and doing the daily work at our institutions. The board should keep faculty first and foremost in mind with any changes contemplated. Although the AUP statement is not meant to be a blueprint, it does envision that a board has a limited role, even as the board might be the final institutional authority on some decision making. The board ensures publication of policies that are jointly decided, oversees resources and endowments, including being responsible to obtain needed funds. The board should rely on expertise from others, such as being guided by the long-term planning by the institutions in your oversight role. And above all, the board should be an advocate for institutions, especially in times of crisis. In being advocates for faculty and students, the board can defend our educational good provided to our communities. It is with these guidelines in mind that I believe the board would be in error to reduce the role of the chancellor position to a mere administrator or to eliminate the chancellor role altogether. Our institutions operate full-time. The work of coordinating our system of two-year and four-year institutions is a full-time task. We need a full-time chancellor with the skills and academic experience to coordinate such efforts. Successful collaboration coordinated by a respected leader means better educational access and outcomes for Nevada. A board that meets occasionally with limitations of open meeting law just cannot do this kind of work, nor should it. A chancellor hired through a joint decision-making process with faculty at all institutions also ensures that the direction of policy for our institutions is not a product of partisan interest or is a benefit of being a political donor. A chancellor that comes from an academic background is also the most qualified to evaluate and supervise presidents at our institutions, as well as they would be knowledgeable of the personnel policies to engage in appropriate disciplinary action. Having the supervisory role change year to year with the election of board chairs would be inefficient and would leave uncertainty year to year. Continuity and stability are needed in education. I support the board's goals in clarifying roles, creating clear expectations for evaluation of leaders, and hope that this exercise is helpful overall for the board to learn more about our system and policies. Above all, keep the interests of the educational mission in mind with your decision making today, including faculty perspectives in your thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further public comment? Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Dubrava and Regents. For the record, my name is Eric Marchand, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-D. I teach and conduct research in the College of Engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno, and I am honored to be chair of the Faculty Senate there. This is an important time for the Nevada System of Higher Education as we navigate emerging from the pandemic, as we prepare for the upcoming legislative session, and seek to attract a new chancellor to lead our higher education initiatives within Nevada. In my previous comments on this topic in August, I encouraged the board to utilize a measured and metrics-oriented approach to modifying the chancellor's role. I am heartened by the deliberative and open nature of this ad hoc committee's work. It has been noted in previous comments that this process is as much a discussion about the roles and responsibilities of the Board of Regents as it is a discussion relating to the Chancellor position. I agree with that sentiment. As the Board considers options, I would encourage Regents to embrace the Chancellor position as more than a Chief Administrator or CEO of the system. There are certainly numerous Chancellor responsibilities that fall into administrative categories, but having a Chancellor who is intentionally labeled as the Chief Academic Officer of the system will enable academic leadership for the system to meet the evolving needs of the state. For NCHE to meet its ultimate potential, we need a leader who can coordinate activities among our system institutions and has the authority to make high-level decisions. The Board of Regents plays a critical role in this process by providing strong advocacy for the system with the legislature, setting an overall vision for higher education in the state, providing oversight of higher education initiatives in Nevada, and making high-level hiring decisions. Having a chancellor who has the authority to implement a coherent strategy is key to achieving our collective goals as we grow and enhance our NCHE institutions. As Acting Chancellor Urquiaga has conveyed previously, the relationship between the chancellor and institution presidents is what he considers the hardest part of the job. The chancellor can be stuck in the middle when it comes to accountability with presidents directly reporting to the board. I would submit that this position would be even more tenuous if the chancellor role were eliminated or if the chancellor had a position equal to presidents. Along these lines, having a chancellor with an active role in the presidential evaluation process would actually provide equity and stability for presidents by providing consistency in their evaluation process. Since Board of Regents chair and vice chair positions may change from year to year, these changes in leadership could result in a moving target for expectations and direction of NCHE institutions. As a chief academic leader of higher education in Nevada, the chancellor should have the flexibility to lead in a nimble manner while being accountable to and obtaining counsel from the Board of Regents. I would like to propose a few key traits and roles for the effective chancellor that I hope the board will embrace. They must first be able to adapt to a higher education environment that is rapidly changing. This requires authority. They must be able to lead educational change and innovation. This requires authority. They must be able to challenge the system institutions to consider new models for excellence. This requires authority. In closing, shared governance is a critical component of higher education, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide input on this important matter. Thank you again for allowing me to share my perspective. I look forward to the work of this committee.
Thank you.
Kent Irvin, ERVIN, Nevada Faculty Alliance. Chair Dubrava, Vice Chair Perkins, and committee members, thank you for your service and the opportunity to provide input. We welcome the discussion of the roles and duties of chancellors and today's guidance document that lays out options on its structure. The mutual goal is a well-functioning governance system. A discussion of the roles and duties of the chancellor is also necessarily a discussion of the roles and duties of the board itself and of the presidents. For example, if you decide to go down the route of a chancellor in a coordinating role, that implies that the board will assume full responsibility for appointing, directing, evaluating presidents. That's not a question of the current board membership. It's rather a question of whether an elected body subject to the open meeting law with no compensation for extra time spent by board officers is a valid model. On the other hand, if you give the chancellor a stronger role with management authority over the presidents, then this board and future boards must be willing to leave that authority and autonomy with the chancellor and make a priority of hiring a chancellor with broad and deep academic credentials and then providing metrics and evaluations. On the third hand, if you leave the current dual reporting and hybrid structure in place, you must resolve the ambiguities among the in the current bylaws and handbook on the relationships and competing interests among the chancellor, presidents, board chair, and board members, as well as the legislature and governor's office. While it's less disruptive to make small changes, as we heard previously, getting the details right is most important and perhaps more difficult in that case. Finally, I would like to echo the comments of Amy Payson and Eric Marchand about the commitment to shared governance and academic freedom being essential for a healthy and well-functioning system of higher education. Shared governance is not just receiving input from faculty senates to tick it off the box. It's a concept that the faculty are intimately involved in developing policy and have the primary responsibility for curriculum and program issues, academic standards, and academic personnel decisions. Please keep that in mind as you address the duties of the chancellor, presidents, and board members. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other public comment.
There's no more from Rita.
We will go to Elko. Any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing no public comment in Las Vegas, we'll go to item two, the minutes. And that is for possible action. Do I have a motion for approval of the minutes? I have a motion. Regent Perkins, a second.
A second.
We'll go with Regent Calabrala. Any discussion about the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye. Of the committee members, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Item three, chair's report. So here we are in October. I want to express gratitude to the chancellor and vice chancellor Abba, who helped put together this reference material that we'll see, that we'll get through. I also listened to the audio of the two previous meetings, and even though a lot of us would say a few comments, it was kind of dense and packed with a lot of repercussions of what was said, so we had to kind of lay it out like you'll see in the reference material. And I also made sure that we had the other category, just in case what was put together maybe left something out that a regent could recognize and say, oh, but this was also something important, so we have that ability too. Also, there's six members of the committee, so potentially we could have a split vote, and it will be to my discretion if we want to then reconsider with amending some type of motion, or we might just forward that split decision to, in our report, in the minutes, to the chair of the full board. And at her discretion, she can decide what to do with a split committee. So we'll go forward with that. We will go to item four, roles and responsibilities of the chancellor. And this is, of course, for possible action. And we can go to the reference material. And again, this was, I thought, really well done. I might ask the chancellor if you wanted to comment at all before we kind of get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, acting chancellor. So the discussion guide in front of you kind of lays out in chunks, if you will, a manner in which you might consider the roles and responsibilities. So there are really, I think, two big buckets of work following kind of a preparatory question. So the first question is sort of, where are you as a committee on this? Leave it alone, change it a lot, or change it some. I don't know that you have any consensus on that. One cannot tell from listening to you to this point. And so you might, and that's not a criticism, you haven't been pressed to say, so thumb up, thumb down. So you might begin there with question one. And then questions two through, oh dear, now I've got my pages out of order. Two to nine. Nope. 2 to 12 are the major issues that we heard. So you could deal with them one at a time or en masse. The easier piece, frankly, begins thereafter, after question 12, is those items that are today clearly in the handbook at Title I, Article 7, Section 3. Those today are the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor. They're delineated and enumerated, and as I said to you in my little history lesson, some of them have been there since 1969, probably three or four of them. So that's the lighter lift. It's sort of the in, is it in or out, is it still valid? The meaty questions are those first, the first overarching question to the public comment, where are you on the scope of this role? And then that might lead you, Mr. Chair, to facilitate a conversation about the big meaty items in questions 2 through 12, or those more specific responsibilities delineated in the article.
Thank you, Chancellor. Vice Chancellor Eba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Eba, I just wanted to frame for the committee how this document will be used after you go through your deliberations. So this was not in any, so this was a hard document to craft. And what we were trying to do was to craft it in a manner that would guide you so that when Dale and I go back, we can sit down and actually craft the handbook revision that would result from the decisions that you are making today. And so that's why it says, you know, accept, deny, or change in some way, because we will then go through this, and based on the direction that you provide today, we will craft the formal handbook revision and bring that forward to the December meeting for action. So in taking the actions today, this isn't how you normally do it, because normally with a work session, that handbook language is in front of you and you are making a recommendation to move forward. This is to determine consensus for the purpose of the committee, because for many of these items, there was not consensus in the conversation, and that's where we struggled. So if there is no consensus, we won't include it in the draft going forward. So I think it's important for you, Mr. Chairman, to make sure that we are on each of these items determining the extent to which there is agreement. Because with no agreement, I want to be clear that we won't include it in the draft.
And with that said, Vice Chancellor Eba, if there's no agreement, that doesn't preclude the chair of the board putting on the full board agenda some type of agenda item if she feels so fit. I'm keeping the escape clause there, okay? Because we're not going to be here till 7 o'clock at night if we can't reach consensus on an item, believe me. So, and to my committee members, what I wanted to do is I was going to go through the guide numerically, have some discussion. When we come to each point, we don't necessarily have to feel an urge to get a motion out there. We can say, hey, what do you think? What do you think? We're going to hear from the committee members, and then we'll say, hey, I think we have a motion here that we can make, and we vote it up or down. How's that?
Mr. Chair, Region just Perkins. A quick question, a clarification. So you would like a vote on each item, or is it just like general discussion on each item so we get a direction, or is it actually like a motion and a vote?
I think as we go through, just to kind of really make it clear, I think we will cast a vote on each item, whether we decide to do something positive, or I shouldn't use the word positive or negative, take action, leave it alone, or make some kind of refinement or revision. So with that being said, we are going to jump in. Take the easy one first? No, we're going to take the hardest one first, I think. Overarching role of the chancellor. Should the role of the chancellor be revised to a coordinating function, or should it remain as currently structured?
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion about maintaining the current role with minor adjustments and or clarifications.
Okay, wait a minute here. So,
second.
And that was Regent Geddes, that it was the second?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, okay, I understand. It's not kind of the way I wanted it to work, but so there's a motion and a second on the floor. And if I heard you correctly, Regent Perkins, you were saying to maintain the current role as is. Is that what your motion was? That was
with minor adjustments.
With minor adjustments. Okay.
Yeah, that's
and or clarifications. Let's have a discussion about that. And I see Regent Geddes' hand up. Regent Geddes?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think the structure that we have actually does work. We've run into gray areas, and we've had issues that I think we can clarify. But as I've constantly said, I think the most important role as a board we have is hiring the 8 presidents and the chancellor and then letting them run their institutions. But I would hate to get rid of the 9 reporting to us. We also have our staff that we hire and report to us. But to me, those 9 are the most important. And I think we need to maintain that. And to some of the public comment earlier, we always include faculty whenever we do a chancellor search. And we always include faculty as we develop policies. So I don't want you to feel excluded based on what's there. But if there's specific comments in regards to minor adjustments, clarifications, that would be great. But I think we need to keep it as is with minor adjustments.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with this statement. I would like to maintain the current role with minor adjustments and or clarifications. Thank you.
Regent Brooks.
Thank you. Regent Brooks, for the record, the question I would have then was, number one, kicks off several pages of conversation about what that actually looks like. And it seems as though it's written is that we have a choice to either go down some additional considerations for what this role looks like, but it starts with question number one. And so if we are going to agree that we want to maintain the role with adjustments and clarifications, would then those other considerations be included in that? Okay. All right. Yeah, go ahead, Chair. You have something?
When I thought about this, if we pass the motion as stated and we say maintain the current role with minor adjustments and or clarifications, I intend to still go through 2 through 11, or actually 2 through all of the numerals here. We go to 12 on this section. And then, of course, we would then, the second half would be Title I, Article 3, Section 3. So we're going through all of them if that is what we pass here at this question one.
Okay, so essentially, again, Regent Brooks for the record, so essentially where it says that items 2 through 11 would need to be considered, they will be considered regardless of how we're moving forward based on this first question.
That's correct.
Question. Okay,
that's correct.
Thank you, Chair.
And as I was also going to say that I'm supportive of maintaining the current role with minor adjustments, so I'm in favor of that motion. No other comments? I think all in favor of the motion and the second, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any committee members opposed? Any abstentions? So we are going down the path now with the current role and minor adjustments and clarifications. So, with that in mind, we come to board employees. Discuss defining in the handbook key positions and where those positions report. On our committee, do any regents have suggestions about the reporting, the direct reports? Any suggestions regarding the presidents?
Chair DeBrava.
Mr. Chair.
Regent Brooks, and then we'll go Regent Geddes.
So I was going to offer, Chair, in both of those, there should be some definition of what this looks like in terms of the board employees, the chancellor, chief of staff, special counsel, and chief internal auditor, because I think there are some areas in the handbook where particularly maybe there's not enough information regarding the chief internal auditor. And so I think that should be reexamined so that we're including all of that in there. And if we're going to do that with what those employees look like, then maybe there's an opportunity to clarify reporting processes from the presidents of the institutions.
Regent Geddes.
I was just going to echo that comment and apologize to Jimmy. I always forget that he reports to us. But I would agree with that, just clarifying some of those definitions and those reporting structure. And then, yeah, do you want to go to presidents or finish that part?
You know, let's stay with direct reports. And then I was going to have Vice Chancellor Abba go ahead, please.
So I'm going to try to not jump in all the time like this, but I just want so Regent Geddes, just for clarification, you said Jimmy, and I think you meant Joe. So Joe Sunbury is your chief internal auditor who reports to the board. And the position of chief of staff and special counsel, of course, is Mr. Kilroy. And, of course, we know who the chancellor is and that position. So this would simply codify very specifically those are your employees where you have direct supervision and a direct solid line in an org chart.
I rescind my apology to Jimmy, and I apologize to Joe.
So with the direct reports, it's going to stay as is. And then with the presidents, should the board handbook be amended to clarify the president's report to the board for the purpose of supervision and evaluations?
I have a question, actually. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Regent Perkins. I guess it's going to be directed at Crystal or Vice Chancellor, Executive Vice Chancellor Abba. Okay, you mentioned dotted lines and solid lines. So the presidents now, are they a dotted line to the Board of Regents, or are they a solid line to the Board of Regents in the reporting structure?
No, you go ahead.
Yeah. For the record, Dale Arquiaga, I'm not sure Crystal and I agree on this, because my answer is, who knows? I don't think you can draw the current reporting relationship of the presidents to the board or the chancellor under the current structure. The board hires, the board fires, the chancellor supervises, so I don't know what that is. That's my answer.
Well, that's clear as mud. But is that your final answer?
I agree with the chancellor, and I think... Sorry. Who am I? Executive Vice Chancellor Crystal Abba, for the record. I agree with the chancellor. I mean, that's part of the challenge that we have. And it's important to also understand the second part of the phrase there, which is for the purpose of supervision and evaluations. Because that, you're going to get to other items in here that deal with presidential evaluations. And what you may, if you want to revise this in any way, you may want to say, okay, there is a solid line for the purpose of supervision, but in other words, this could be either or, but not for evaluations, or it could be for evaluations and not for supervision.
General Counsel Martinez, I think, wants to weigh in.
I just wanted to add a point of clarification on this issue, and I think it'll be important for the committee moving forward to pay close attention to those details, because as the Chancellor and Crystal both pointed out, it's kind of a dotted line, but it's kind of not, because in the bylaws, the supervision is directly done by the chancellor, but the chancellor does not have authority to discipline, hire, and fire solely. So you have the board is the appointing authority, so it takes the board's action to fire anybody, and even though the chancellor is supervisory, the chancellor also does not have authority to discipline without consulting the chair also. So there's a lot of moving parts to this issue. So it is a very complex scenario.
Regent Carter, did you have some comments?
My comment was going to be somewhat similar, but I've got a couple thoughts. So one of the overarching, thoughts to this is the chancellor either has power through the board and he's acting on the board's power, or he has power on his own. And those are two different power structures. So one, we've hired a person and then they have a rank of power outside of what the board establishes as a goal or whatever, and the power comes from the board. The other thing is, and this is one of the odd things to me, is the board hires presidents, the board fires presidents, but after we hire the president, we pass it on to the chancellor to manage, and then our evaluation process is a mess at, at best on a good day. And so I think, you know, dividing these or clarifying what that is, I think if we're the only people that can fire them, we probably have to be pretty heavily involved in their evaluation. But at the same time, if we totally cut that out from under the chancellor, then what's the chancellor's authority besides running to the board every time a president does something they, you know, don't like?
Thanks for those comments. And Regent Del Carlo and then Regent Brooks.
Regent Geddes is before me, Chair.
How about I put Regent Del Carlo, Geddes, Brooks?
I'll defer because I'm not on the committee, so let them go first, please.
Regent Geddes.
Am I supposed to defer? I'm kidding. I know. I just want to make sure that we have the solid lines. To Regent Carter's comment, the Chancellor's authority is what we delegate as the board. So it goes from us to the Chancellor. And the way we've, and sorry for being a broken record, but the way we've done it in the past is, you know, we're in charge of the 3-year evaluation, which is now 4-year. But the Chancellor is in charge of the day-to-day operations of the system office and coordinating with all the presidents. But as was stated, any discipline or anything like that would have to go up through the board, and not just through the board chair, but up through the board if we're going to take action. But those annual evaluations are from the chancellor, and he can set goals and recommendations for the presidents, and then we would include those in the 360 evaluation of the presidents when we get to that point. So that's, I think we have to keep it that way to make it very clear that the presidents do report to us.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. And as we sort of, I know it relates to evaluations in that, but as we're on this item two, it's kind of the reporting of the presidents. Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. So in line with what Regent Geddes just offered, the reporting processes should be from the presidents to the board, and if that's part of the chancellor's process, I don't have any objection to that, and maybe that's the way that it could work effectively. However, I would offer that the president's reporting to the board is not because the board is supervising the presidents. The president's reporting to the board is so that the board holds the presidents accountable for goals matrix and other processes that should be taking place at the institutions based on board recommendations in terms of policy and procedures. And so I just wanted to add some clarification, because the word and idea of the board supervising the presidents, it seemed as though if we were holding them accountable, that might be a better way to phrase the purpose of what the reporting is for.
Thank you. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair DeBrava. To Regent Yeti's point, if we're doing, as a board, if we're doing the 4-year evaluation, this is my 6th year on the board, if this is the way it's been, I don't remember ever having any input on a president's evaluation. We've had input on a chancellor's evaluation, but I've never had one on a president's that I recall. Have we?
So,
I don't recall.
With my years on the board, there used to be a regent committee for conducting the president's periodic evaluation that was 3 years at the time. And I think, were regents only on the committee, or did a regent chair that committee for evaluation?
A regent did chair it, but we changed it a few years back so that the chancellor appointed a committee of faculty and outside member, and then hired a consultant to go in and get evaluations from all the faculty, staff, students, and put together a report. And then that report is what is given to us, Regent Del Carlo. And that's basically a summary of all of that. And a lot of the questions in that are directed by the chancellor's annual evaluation of the presidents. So it's a way to roll up those annuals into the 360 review, but then we get all that data when we do the presidential evaluations.
Did that help, Regent Del Carlo? Did that help?
Well, that helped, but I just don't recall Regent Geddes that happened. I mean, I think it's because we've gotten so far away for so many basic things. So thank you.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Regent Brava. I have lots of questions. If I was an employee, I don't know how I'd feel about having 13 supervisors. It would be ineffective, just too much, too many ideas, too many people coming at you all at once. So I feel really comfortable with delegating that to the chancellor. But the other thing is, if we give the chancellor the ability to set the goals and then don't give him the authority to do something when those goals aren't met, that's self-defeating also. Just throwing that out there. And I think I do remember we got a report when we renewed contracts. I think it was our first year on the board, Amy. We got the report, but we did not participate necessarily in the evaluation. But we got a report that was a hybrid and collaborated and combined that we got, and we voted yes or no on that.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you. Now, that was really probably my point, is that, yes, we did get a report. You're right. But nobody's ever come to us as regents, at least not to me, unless I got excluded, of what my perceptions and performance evaluation or whatever the questions are that's being asked in that evaluation. I mean, we all interact in different levels and means, and I see some presidents more than I see others just because of geographics, et cetera. But I really think between 13 of us, they should ask us, or maybe it's a standardized form we end up putting together or something, but we should have a pretty good say, and that information should go to the chancellor during that annual review and then when we do that, the four-year, the big review.
Mr. Chair. I would completely agree with that. I think we should be asked. We should be included somehow, whether we get a questionnaire or a 15-minute interview or something about how we interact with the president. I think that's kind of really important in further evaluations.
Whereas some chancellors might have done that, not defined that they had to do it, but they might have just reached out to regents to get input regarding the president's while they put their evaluation together.
So I guess we need to define it? Okay.
Maybe so. Let me go to Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. Well, I have a question for our legal counsel on that. Are there open meeting law issues involved with asking regents for their input? And is it possible to be able to do that outside of a meeting? And is there a way to do that? I know that in the past there have been, I think was with the chancellor, that there was like a general question asked of regents, does anybody have any input kind of anonymously on the chancellor's evaluation? Is there a way to do that with presidents? Or, I mean, maybe we don't even want to do it in an anonymous way. I just want to have that dialogue regarding how we can do that with open meeting law. And I know that there's another question further down in our list of discussion questions regarding if we can open this up to, or really not really open it up, but close it as a closed personnel session. And maybe my questions are kind of leading towards that. And if the committee thinks that that's more of a question to get to later, then I'm happy to defer that. But I'm just curious if we can even go that route with asking for our input.
And before I go to Regent Boylan or go to legal to get an answer, and my understanding is there's nothing in the open meeting law that would prevent a sitting chancellor to discuss individually with all regents, not deliberate, but say, give me your input on President X. And then the chancellor can take those thoughts and formulate or contribute to his or her evaluation of a president. General Counsel Martinez? Oh, Counsel Kilroy.
Allow me to address the questions by Vice Chair Carvalho, and Jimmy, you can pine in accordingly. It's my understanding that the annual evals are generally closed, but for it, there's a change in the contract. And then for it, it would be an open matter. And then with regard to the three-year periodics, those are by nature, are far more open. And there's two different kind of procedures for them. And so it all depends, in my opinion, on where it is along. Is it the annual or is it the periodic? And I'll defer to System General Counsel.
And Chief General Counsel James Martinez, for the record. Yeah, specifically to your question about the chancellor having conversations with individual regents, as long as those conversations are with less than a quorum of the board and there's no walking quorum where, you know, you're deliberating by talking to multiple regents and explaining what other regents had said, then yes, you're right. There would be no open meeting law violation for the chancellor essentially briefing regents and allowing them to receive information and get feedback.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not on this committee, but I think maybe a dichotomous relationship would be great, like having a committee, subcommittee of the board and the chancellor, if we consider keeping the chancellor's position, which I don't think we should, but I'm not on this committee. We'll see about that later. But we could have a subcommittee that would do the evaluations either on a yearly or biannual basis. 4 years to evaluate somebody in a job, that's kind of, I've never heard of that. So I think it could be a combination of the two, but more often. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. So for this question number two, right, it's already been alluded to by Chair Carvalho that the evaluation part does come up in seven, and I think that's what we can have some robust conversation regarding what that may look like. In terms of 2B, if we just kind of left it simply as the board for the purpose of accountability, and even if for the purposes of our discussion we left out evaluations for this moment, right, regarding this number two, because we get to come back to it on number seven, then I would say that we would want to implement a dual reporting process so that the board and the chancellor are getting reports. Again, from the board's perspective, it is merely for accountability, not supervision. And that when we are looking at the clarification language, the chancellor provides support. The chancellor should provide support and coordination with the presidents. But when we talk about direction, that could be left up to the discretion of the presidents, based on the familiarity those presidents have in the experience in that institution. And so if we bring in a new president, then maybe there's room for that president to have some discussion with the chancellor about support and direction of how policy should flow. But if perhaps this is a seasoned president at an institution with a new chancellor, then maybe the best person to implement policy and procedure on the campus is going to be through the support of the chancellor, but essentially being done by the president and how the president of that university feels those things should be implemented. Thank you, Chair.
I almost think there was a motion in there somewhere, but I'm looking at Vice Chancellor Abba. So are you clear on this now? The dual reporting nature, I think, is we still want that dual reporting, and then it does get kind of dicey and dotted line, but what do you think?
So for the record, Crystal Abba, no. I do think that if we keep these two items separate, so I don't know if, Mr. Chairman, you want to consider item A. It does appear that we have consensus on item A. So there appears to be no objection to defining in the handbook your direct reports. As for item B, I am not comfortable in terms of the level of consensus, so I would recommend a motion.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba. I'm just looking for any comments. I did, Regent Brooks did kind of drill down, and I appreciated how that wording that you mentioned, hey, in this instance, it's not necessarily direction, supervision. So if you think you can formulate that into knowing that we're going to talk about presidential evaluations later on, let's just talk about reporting. And if you want to help define the language.
Thank you, Chair Regent Brooks, for the record. So what I would offer is that the handbook would be amended to clarify that the president's report to the chancellor and the board for purposes of accountability, and that the chancellor will provide support to the president's in implementing board policy concerning the management of each institution.
That's a motion.
Second.
And we have a second from Regent Geddes, I believe. And then discussion or thoughts on that. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Chair. To go back to the solid or the dotted line, so now we're doing two solid lines from the president's, one going to the chancellor, one going to the Board of Regents. Is that what the motion is?
Regent Brooks, for the record, what I would offer is that it is a dual reporting process.
So two solid lines.
If we want to call them solid lines of reporting, then I would offer then maybe if we're making a diagram, would probably look like, where we have a reporting system that includes from the presidents, the reports are going to the chancellor and to the board. I would imagine that the chancellor might look at those a little bit differently in terms of what that level of accountability looks like from the chancellor's perspective. But for the board, certainly the board would want to have a level of accountability on the president's actions with policy that the board has voted on to pass to support processes at the institutions.
Okay. And I guess a follow-up question. So where does disciplinary recommendations, guidance, where does that fall?
Regent Brooks, for the record, so that is actually in another part of this agenda item, another question. And what I was trying to do in hopes of moving things along was essentially looking at each piece of this separately, and then as those questions come up, evaluations, disciplinary action, then we can have those conversations at that time.
And Regent Perkins, I think I'm comfortable with that we will get to that later on, just for clarification. And with your definition of, you know, the reporting, you know, with the solid line, dashed line, sometimes it can't be represented graphically. And, you know, with okay, that's all I'll say.
You're talking to a Venn diagram person, yeah. So it has to be.
I think Regent Geddes has his hand up. Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, for Crystal and Dale, is I think in the evaluation that we heard earlier, there seems to be confusion as far as those reporting lines. So I think any clarifying language that could be added in so that, you know, every regent knows they can talk to every president, or when we're talking to a president, we should always copy the chancellor or something, just some sort of clarifying language so it's clear that the nine of them report to us, but that all the board members know what they can and can't do.
Thank you. Let me go to Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I guess I have a question. I don't have the policy in front of me right now, but what is our current policy on how this reporting structure is laid out? Do we not have a clear line of accountability for presidents to the board currently?
Do you have it open?
No, go ahead, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, and I just lost my place in the handbook. Section 4 of Title 1 of your bylaws says the presidents report to the chancellor for the administration of their respective institutions and are accountable through the chancellor to the Board of Regents.
So, exactly. Since Regent Brooks left, I'm not sure. I feel like what he's proposing now is basically what we already have in policy. And so I wanted to make that clear with him. And maybe when he returns, we can do that. My other comment is that I feel that we are currently holding presidents accountable for their institutions through their reports and presentations to us as the board. So I'm, again, not exactly sure what changes. Regent Brooks, thank you for returning. My questions are really for you.
Regent Carvalho, yes. The chancellor repeat, if you would read that one more time. This is what the current language is.
This is very exciting. I feel like Phantom White. The presidents report to the chancellor for the administration of their respective institutions and are accountable through the chancellor to the Board of Regents. That's existing language.
And Regent Carvalho then had, she was thinking, I'll let you speak.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if that language mirrors what your suggested motion was. I just want to be sure that I understand if there is a change that you would like to make, that I understand what that change is.
Thank you, Regent Brooks, for the record. So I guess it's really in honing in the defining aspects of what this looks like, right? And so that it isn't ambiguous to anybody in terms of communication between the presidents and board members, as Regent Geddes had spoke about, and that it's very clear that the dual reporting process exists for the purposes of the board holding those presidents accountable. I mean, we can take a look at wordsmithing what the current policy is to kind of match up the discussion that we're having now. And look, if we find that it already exists exactly as we're describing, then great. I'm just not so sure that it does specifically based on the conversation that we're having right now.
And Chancellor, I think you wanted to clarify something or suggest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dale Urquiaga. So trying not to get out over my skis here, I have a suggestion for your motion, perhaps. The language that I read you is in the description of the presidents. It is not a role of the chancellor. And so perhaps one could clarify that reporting relationship and the accountability process in the chancellor's section so it was clearer to all parties.
I think that helps, Regent Carvalho.
I would support that motion based on what the chancellor just said.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I didn't realize the definition that was provided was specifically for the presidents, not the role of the chancellor. And as we're having conversations about role of the chancellor, I think it's fitting that we have the motion.
And Regent Geddes, do you concur with that?
Concur.
Vice Chancellor Abba, you know where we're heading now, right? I think we're...
I do. Thank you.
I hear that smirk, Chair McAdoo. No, I was being facetious, but you're like, hey, this is not an easy task. And it's like, oh, what are you doing? Yeah, okay. So we have this motion.
The only other comment to think about is to pile on to what Dale said was maybe just inverting the language a bit, since it's in the duties of the chancellor, that, you know, we delegate those duties to the chancellor to oversee the presidents. But either way, it's just something that popped in my head.
So he did concur with this nebulous motion, Regent Carter.
So I'll just say my concern, and then I think maybe this addresses it. So the concern is we don't want a chancellor that comes in as a super president to think that they're in control of UNR, UNLV, or something like that. They're here to support the presidents. So I think, you know, helping define the role of the president reporting to the board helps kind of eliminate that idea that maybe the chancellor thinks that they're a, you know, uber president over, you know, the institutions. Their power comes through the board for policy. So I don't know if any of that needs to be wordsmithed in there, if that makes sense.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I'm following what Regent Carter said, because what the Chancellor just read to us, it looks like what we have is the President's answer directly to him, not to the board. Am I correct, or am I a wee bit off? Chancellor, anyone? No? Am I correct? What you just read in the Chancellor's role, or was it the President's role, that they answer to the Chancellor directly, not to the board? So are we making that clear? Or am I just... I know it's beer time somewhere, but I'm a wee bit confused.
For the record, Dale Urquiaga, Regent Boylan, I think the language can be confusing. And so I think that both Regent Carter's language and Regent Getty's solution of sort of inverting the role, accountable to the board comes last in this iteration. And so what I'm hearing is the board would prefer to state clearly that presidents are accountable to the board and that the board has delegated its reporting authority to the chancellor. Like, you don't want to fill out their timesheets, guys. Like, that's what I do. I approve their time. So, but you wish to put yourselves in the accountability role. And that's kind of buried here in this. So if I'm understanding the two regents' comments and I see them nodding, so that's a good sign that I'm still in the right meeting, I think we can write it that way and put it in the role of the chancellor section. That will be less confusing.
Thanks, Chancellor. I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Regent Perkins.
Okay, is that better? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Regent, or Chair DeBrava. I think that what I was concerned with is that the presidents would just completely jump over the chancellor and come to the board instead of going to the chancellor to solve issues that are, campus related. But that the language that was just given kind of solves that and puts me at ease that there is a direct line from the presidents through the chancellor to the board.
But that's so, not a direct line, sorry.
Well it was kind of. It's almost a direct line. It's a direct dotted line. I don't know. But yes.
Sorry,
but yes, that's what I was believing. Then that language kind of puts me at ease for.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
I'm confident that we've got it.
And as chair, I was going to say to Regent Brooks and to Regent Getty's maker of a motion that we had, maybe this one we don't need a motion. We have a consensus. Have we reached a consensus on the committee members of what was discussed here that Vice Chancellor Abba and the Chancellor can put something together? I think we do.
We're waiting on your response.
There, so... That was a tough one here. And that's only number two.
Yeah.
Okay, number three.
So just for the record, Chair, right? Again, Regent Brooks, I just want to make sure for the record that we have clarified this and that while we did not have an approval of motion, we have consensus on the board that this will be wordsmith revamped in accordance with the way we just spoke about it now.
Yes, we have consensus from the committee in terms of the direction that you have provided to the chancellor and I, and we will accordingly revise the handbook and bring that back in December. Yes.
Thank you.
We got it.
Thank you. So item three, direction of the committee. The chancellor has direct reports, and the chancellor shall appoint a CFO, CGC, and a CAO. And we're comfortable with that, or I'll have comments. Regent Geddes.
Just a brief comment, Ms. Chair, and you'll remember back in the day we used to have to approve all those positions. So the chancellor would make a recommendation and bring it to the board. And, you know, we kind of went back to the Governor Kenny Gwynn model where he basically said, give me my budget, tell me how to run, and I'll run my office as we need to run the office to assist all the institutions and get things going. So, I think it should stay as is where the chancellor appoints those three positions. And the only time salary should come to us if it's outside of the approved salary range.
We have Regent Carter, Perkins, Brooks.
I guess I'm in the minority because I've always said that, you know, the chief cabinet positions that come in tend to survive or out-survive our chancellor. So we get, I hate to use the word stuck, but we get those people to stay on past when the, you know, the chancellor leaves. So I think it would be useful to have the opportunity to weigh in on those positions, but I'm leaving the board so it doesn't
matter. Regent Perkins.
I guess my question actually was for the historian, Regent Geddes.
Gotcha.
So, okay, when it was how the board selected all these people and voted on all these people, what are the differences between now and then? Was it more effective then? Is it more effective now? And what makes it more effective now or then?
Regent Geddes, please.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I think it's more effective now. I mean, we had to wait until an agenda to get a hire in position. So if the chancellor went out and hired a CFO, we had to wait until the next board meeting, put on the agenda, and then we would actually end up talking about the person and what their qualifications were and talking about their salary in our open public meetings. And it made searches difficult, as you know. So we had some candidates drop out once it got to that point, but we had to confirm all of them. And just a brief aside, we also used to have to approve every single athletic contract, track coach, volleyball coach, every single athletic contract. And it's just kind of too much for us to get in that position. You know, if Dale goes out and he finds a CFO to replace Andrew, he should find that and then report it to all of us. Not that you're being replaced, Andrew, just to throw it out as an example. But I think it's much more efficient now with it, because then the chance they all report to him and through him to the board. Yeah. Crystal's been here longer than me, so she may have a better answer.
She's okay. She's okay right now. I'm going to go Regent Brooks and then to Regent Carter.
Thank you, Chair. The only thing I wanted to add, and I agree with Regent Geddes, is that the chancellor should appoint those positions. What I would offer is that while the annual evaluations of cabinet members and salary adjustments do not need to be reported to the board, approved to the board, they should be reported to the board. And the actual percentage in which, when we start taking a look at salary adjustments, should be 0% is allotted for unreported salary adjustments. In other words, if there's a salary adjustment, just report it to the board. Let us know in terms of transparency of dollar and spend and what it looks like when somebody is getting an adjustment. I think that would be helpful for us to be able to have clear view of things that are happening. And so that's what I would offer. Thank you, Chair.
Regent Carter, and then Chair McAdoo.
As an alternative to actually being approved at a board meeting, what if we had the chair of the board kind of as our designated representative on that search or the interviews, or at least so that they have some sort of buy-in to these cabinet-level positions?
Chair McAdoo.
Thank you. So I know we haven't seen this, or at least I haven't seen it in my 6 years, change in CFO, vice chancellors, those things. However, when we're talking about clarity in our code, This literally says that the chancellor will appoint a CFO, CGC, and CAO. So to me, I interpret that as every time we get a new chancellor, those positions could potentially change. And so I just bring that forth because, I mean, I think we're all working to try to retain good employees, and how does that affect, I'm just going to say those positions now, employment, and how does it affect their salary if they no longer have the title? Because I've seen that salaries are based on titles. It concerns me because I don't, depending on who we got as a chancellor, it appears to me they could change those positions the way we have it worded here.
The more we dig down, the more we're finding. Chancellor.
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, to you and through you to Chair McAdoo. So that's true today. Our staff are all professional staff. They can all be replaced. They all, however, have an agreement that indicates the terms of their notice. So if one has been here for a long time, one's notice period is very long, sometimes so long that if a chancellor made a change, he or she would be paying that individual for a long time and would knock a big hole in their budget. So they don't actually have the latitude to replace those people because there isn't money lying around in a big bucket. I think what this language does is just makes clear these are the positions that are required. CFO and Chief General Counsel are already referenced in the code. They're just sort of buried in amongst other portions. And there is no Chief Academic Officer referenced in the code today. And so I think that is an improvement to be very clear. These are the three leading roles. They are appointed by the chancellor. But you're correct. If a new chancellor came in, he or she could make replacements if he or she had the money to pay for those notice periods under our employment agreements.
So, okay. I guess what it says is we have to be careful about the chancellor we hire, the chancellor we have. I mean, if we're trying to talk about retention of good employees, which I realize all of us know that that's what we have today, and that hasn't happened in the 6 years, but this literally says it could happen. If I realize it takes money, everything we do takes money, but it seems a little muddy to me.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with Chair McAdoo here. I think that's a great point. I didn't think of that. And we've seen what's happened lately. So I think it's, like you said, the more we dig down, drill deeper, I think we'll find more oil. So let's keep going. I think that's a great suggestion. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's a fantastic consideration that our chair of the board just provided. My only concern is that we start taking a look at some type of approved appointment, then we really start getting involved with, I think we might start getting too far into the weeds, right, with employment issues and things that are happening inside the system office. And that's not anything that I'd be interested in partaking in, frankly. But I wonder if that is maybe an employment contract issue rather than an appointment issue, because what we're trying to do here is codify exactly what the chancellor can do, right, outside of the board, without the board approval, in terms of those that body that will work every day with the chancellor. And so we want that chancellor to have the freedom to make the appointments and hires as they see fit. But at the same time, we want to be able to protect our current, cabinet, if you will.
Thank you. Regent Derascotta.
Thank you, Chair. Similar to Regent Boylan, I too am not on this committee. However, I'm kind of geeking out over here on our Regent handbook. Chair McAdoo, could you please repeat that title? You said Title 4, Chapter 3, was it Section 26 you were mentioning about? about the salary schedule. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I wasn't referring to salary schedules. I was referring, and I didn't mention any code on it. I was just reading here in our agenda item that we're on. That's agenda item. Is that three, I think it was? Yeah, three.
Okay.
So I was just referring to, you know, the retention of good employees. And I take what Acting Chancellor Quiaga said seriously, in that it would take money, and the contracts of 20-year employees are long, and they're going to work for us a long time if he were to appoint someone into that position. But, I mean, the truth of the matter is all that costs NSHE money to do that. And to me, worse yet, the potential of losing good qualified employees that are in positions doing a good job. I'm not saying I know an exact answer. I just was bringing it up because I think all of the meeting today, both of them, has been to try to clarify our handbook so that there's not a million questions around something.
And
so thank you.
There are a lot of questions. I was going to... One question I have, the annual evaluations of cabinet members. So is that through, since they're professional employees, is that still through human resources? And that's a confidential evaluation. To Regent Carter's point, do we want to clarify and say that the annual evaluation of the chancellor's cabinet personnel is shared with the board chair? I mean, I don't think you can share an evaluation with the entire board, and then this has to be in public. General Counsel Martinez.
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, currently the board in its position does have access to personnel records.
And I think in the past that's been if a regent with proper notification can say, I want to review a personnel file. There has to be a request, and that has to be approved, or there's a process to do that.
Correct.
There has to be a reason why. Okay.
Right, yeah.
But not in an open meeting. It's not like I want to discuss.
Correct. Couldn't go to an open meeting because it is a confidential personnel record.
So am I sensing that we definitely want to keep the chancellor shall appoint those members of his cabinet or her cabinet? And the board does not have to confirm those appointments. And to Regent Brooks's comment that the board would be a report to the board of any salary adjustments after that hire. So at least the board is aware of what's being done. I think that is a consensus again. And what I'm seeing is affirmative nods. And
Mr. Chairman, can I just clarify the last one? So I'm with you on the first one, appoint the chancellors, not checking the second one in terms of confirmation. And you said any adjustments will be reported to the board, any salary adjustments. So on annual evaluations, are you including that, or are we just going with the second part of the clause?
I think we were going just with the second part of the clause.
Got it.
Because as General Counsel Martinez mentioned, if a regent wanted to see what the evaluation was, he or she can do that. I think we're going to move forward with just a consensus and no voting necessary on that. Item four, we're making progress. Okay, the title. Does this committee, is there an appetite to change the chancellor's title to chief administrative officer or something else? Do I hear anything out there?
Maybe potentate? I'm just teasing.
So, Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. Regent Brooks, for the record. So what I would offer is that as we redefine what the roles are of the chancellor, it might be less confusing for someone, particularly with a job posting, that there be a definitive title of what the position is, so that when someone's looking at it, they're very clear about what they'll be doing. And so the word chancellor to me seems very vague in terms of what this looks like. And if we moved it to chief administrative officer, then it is very clear when somebody is applying for this position exactly the type of role and responsibilities that they might be stepping into should they go through the process and be hired. That was what I wanted to offer in terms of what that might look like. Thank you, Chair.
Regent Geddes.
Mr. Chair, and I would disagree. When you look nationally at academic institutions, its president and its chancellor, you very rarely have a chief or the chief administrative officer. I think we need to keep it as is. When we do a search, we send out the prospectus. Those things are 5 pages long. And if you're going to apply for it, you need to read it. You need to understand it. And I don't think a name change would do anything other than limit our candidate pool.
Let me go to Regent Boylan, and then we'll go to General Counsel Martinez.
Thank you, Chair. In higher education, the word chancellor gives us the total idea that he is the chief executive officer, blah, blah, blah. And I say that because even though I'm against this position, even being around, I think changing that name would not be really good for me.
General Counsel Martinez, then we'll go to Regent Del Carlo.
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, I was just going to point out that the bylaws do currently define the chancellor as the chief executive officer and ex officio treasurer of the system.
Regent Del Carlo, and then Regent Brooks.
Yes, I just want to say, too, on a national level, it's well understood what a chancellor is and that the chief administrative officer would be part of those 5 pages that Regent Geddes mentioned. I mean, all the different duties the person has. So I'm not on this committee, but I'm very comfortable with the word chancellor, and it's a name we've used in our system here in Nevada for many, many years. Is that correct, historian Regent Geddes? How far back can you remember the word chancellor being used?
I think in the staff report, they said 1969.
You're after you started. You're after you started? Or?
Regent Geddes gets an A- for not close reading. The board gave the position the title chancellor in 1968, and the legislature codified it in 1969.
Okay.
I was 5.
I'll take that
at the time. Let's be clear. I was not here.
Regent Carter.
I don't think it's worth the effort of trying to change it since it's codified in NRS.
No.
I'm of the same feeling on that, but it's obviously good to bring it up, and I think there's no appetite to change the title. That's what I'm seeing. So we can move to item 5. Oh, what do we have here? Eliminate the role of chancellor. Let's dig down on this. Eliminate the role of chancellor throughout the handbook. Yeah, so I don't think we have to go to item 5, do we? Should the role of chancellor be eliminated? Supervision of all? No. So we're just skipping item 5 because of how we've started down this path. We're just making minor clarifications and adjustments. Discipline of the chancellor. Should the provisions of the handbook delineating the progressive discipline procedures for a president also apply to the chancellor?
I think there needs to be some form of evaluation that the board chair and vice chair are responsible for doing for the chancellor. It says that, the discipline procedures. I think, yes, what's applied to the president should also be applied to the chancellor.
And then also, Regent Perkins, you made reference to chair and vice chair in
chair
some
manner.
Chair.
Right, because I don't know. We have to discuss that, right?
Because
do we want it done in public? Do we want it to be 100% transparent? There's other questions that
There's a lot there. And then it also mentions, do we want to have a sub administered by committee of the board? So again, we're going discipline. And we kind of, obviously that goes to, in a way, evaluating the chancellor. Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to go back, if you don't mind. I'm kind of confused. I missed it, I think. But why did we eliminate the eliminating of the role of the chancellor, that part? What happened? I missed it, I'm sure.
Number one, how we've gone down that route, that we're making adjustments and minor alterations to the role. And then we just on number four said we're going to keep the title as chancellor. So there was really no reason to say we want to eliminate the role of the chancellor. So just by default, number five kind of dismissed.
Right. Thank you, sir.
So now on number six, discipline of the chancellor. So the progressive discipline procedures for the president, do we want them to apply to the chancellor? And is that to be administered by the chair of the board only, or to be administered by the chair and vice chair, or by a committee? Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would recommend it be administered by the chair and vice chair of the board. As you know, they meet with the chancellor every single week, and they're most attuned to what's going on as opposed to forming a committee and going through that process. And I think the progressive discipline should apply to them as administered by the chair and vice chair, keeping in mind that any discipline has to go to the full board for approval. So we're always part of the process, but the chair and vice chair can put it together to bring to the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Geddes, Regent Carter, and then Regent Brooks.
I would say vice chair and chair as well. I would love to see us have a committee, but I think we really need to figure out what that looks like and get our whole legal team together to figure out what we'd need to ask for to be able to get that to happen in reality and the parameters that would happen in, because I don't think there's a method to do that right now.
Thank you. I think Regent Brooks, then Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. Regent Brooks, for the record. I took a look at this one in the same manner probably other regents did in terms of what it might look like to have. Go back. I absolutely agree that the progressive disciplinary procedures should be equal regarding the president and the chancellor. What I was trying to take a look at is, what does that really look like when we're talking about the board? And would it be the sole responsibility of the chair and vice chair to make determinations? And what I thought, and I'm not sure if it would work, but I'll throw it out there, is that maybe it's not just the vice chair, the chair and the vice chair. And while we couldn't do a subcommittee, because that would be difficult based on the conditions in which we sit and with open meeting law, I'm wondering if there's a possibility of having something where at least maybe two additional or three members of the board are included in the conversation only for consult, where nothing could be voted upon, but it would be just a barometer check with additional buy-in from other board members. And the way that I was looking at it was, this absolutely would be for consultation only, and it could be something that either an individual, much like our subcommittees, individuals are either selected or appointed by the chair, or if there are individuals that say, hey, listen, I want to be part of any type of discussion that has to do with disciplinary action, then that individual would be invited to be part of that conversation in a consult form only, and that we would essentially switch out yearly who those three individuals would be. Now, maybe that's two individuals to protect the board. Maybe it's none of the above. I don't know. I was just trying to think of a way of a little bit more buy-in from members of the board prior to it actually going to an action item to the board on an agenda. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Regent Brooks. Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. That Patrick keeps beating this Patrick to the mic, so I kind of follow what he said. We should have like a small... No, it was before me, earlier, but... A subcommittee, because just leaving it on two people from the board, we could have a yes and a no. Now we are stuck. So if we have an odd number, like three, so something could be done. Also, it wouldn't become a personal issue with the chair and the chancellor like we already had in this past year or two. So I think having a subcommittee is a great idea, and what Regent Brooks said is also great, but I think it should be at least three.
Yeah, and
so we can make a decision.
I see Regent Getty's hand. I was just going to say the complexity of how to work that is a challenge with open meeting law. And then this discipline, even a discussion of that is like, well, that's open to the public. Whereas, you know, you have to take into consideration the chancellor's professional career. To Regent Getty's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to kind of steal language from Agenda Item 7. Looking at the presidents, but if you look at that, it's the chancellor and chair and vice chair conduct the annual evaluations, and then they consult and or survey other regents. And I think if those two were adopted, it could address Regent Brooks's concern, where it's not just the two regents, but they can go out and get other information from other regents.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, I just want to clarify for the committee's edification that the way this is currently written is that you would apply the progressive discipline procedures that currently apply to the presidents to the chancellor. So you would be maintaining the same standard that you currently have for presidents to the chancellor. And to give you an idea of what that section says, so again, this is progressive. So if someone does something wrong, you issue a warning. They do it again, you issue another warning, but this time it's in writing. So it talks about steps of progression. I think the more people, and that's what you've got to keep in mind, the chair and vice chair seems to make perfect sense. When you start to bring that to a broader group, you're going to enter a realm of disagreement in terms of, is this even appropriate for progressive discipline? So I think perhaps if you think of it in that context, that what you're trying to do here is to apply the exact same standard that you currently apply to presidents to a similar executive level position being the chancellor without changing that process. Because once you change that process, then you have one set of rules for the chancellor and another set of rules for your president. That's why it's written very concisely to say, you're going to apply the progressive discipline procedures currently applied to the presidents to the chancellor. When you go beyond that, you're starting to blow it up a little bit, sort of what I'm saying.
Regent Boylan.
I was just going to throw this out there. Since we were looking for, like Regent Boylan said, maybe we can have like the another person from the internal auditor be a part of that committee, or somebody that's impartial, so to speak, to be a part of the chair and the vice chair, and then have that third person to avoid what Regent Boylan was speaking of what one yes and one, yeah, one no. And I'd also like to see it go to the direction of a committee, because it's like in the county manager's is public. It's completely public and transparent.
Regent Boylan, then the chancellor.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I really wasn't talking about discipline. I had no idea that this was headed towards discipline. I was just talking more about evaluation of the chancellor and to protect the chair, because okay, we saw what happened. So I apologize if this was about discipline.
Yeah, and the only reason we, with Regent Getty's, we were looking at some similar language on 7, which was evaluations of presidents, but we're still on 6
for all
discipline.
Right. All right.
Discipline of the chancellor.
Sorry.
You're okay? Okay. So, in response to Regent Brooks, you know, with what you had mentioned, and I just don't know how we could do that beyond the chair and vice chair.
Richard Burks, for the record. No, I appreciate that, Chair. I think we're all in consensus that the progressive discipline procedures will be equal for the president and the chancellor. That was the easy one. I think the other one is, should the provisions be administrated by the chair and vice chair? And that's where I was trying to include other members of the board in a discussion in terms of what that might look like. But if it becomes something that is just far too complicated based on our open meeting laws, then I could easily understand why it's just not something that can be done.
Well, and I think there is, if we can move forward as far as eventually, if there's some change in the Nevada revised statute, or if there's something we can do to craft a subcommittee, that's always maybe something to explore. Regent Carter.
Building off of Regent Perkins' idea, maybe like if we spelled out the, if there is a disagreement between the chair and the vice chair, maybe it's the chair of audit or the chair of business and finance, where we list specific, the tiebreaker specifically to a chair of a committee.
Yeah, I like that suggestion because, if we're going to say it's going to be administered by the chair and vice chair, if they are not in agreement, then there has to be, the next step is who's called in, and then I'm going to just kind of call on Regent Geddes. If that were to happen, Regent Geddes, is that something that the chief auditor, or would it be another a regent on a committee?
I would say the chair of the committee.
The chair of the committee of a committee that we decide right now. Regent Geddes, thoughts on that?
I was just going to say it should be the auditor or our general counsel. Two people report directly to the board and not through without adding in that third regent.
Chancellor.
For the record, Dale Arquiaga, so I'm going to try not to do this very much, but I disagree with that. I think it should be a regent and not a staff member with whom the chancellor has to work, who gets to be the tiebreaker. I think consulting the regent who chairs the audit committee in the event of a tie between the chair and the vice chair is appropriate, not due respect to your staff with whom I have to work every day.
and if for some reason the chair of the audit committee, if that's what we think is the appropriate person to settle a tiebreaker, or if the chair of the audit committee happens to be the vice chair of the board, which that could happen, then maybe we do want language to say it would be the board's counsel or another person as an alternate, because that will come up, that the chair of audit will happen to have been the vice chair of the full board.
Mr. Chairman, I would just state where I believe you have consensus now, and maybe that'll help move us along. So you have generally agreed that applying the progressive discipline procedures for the president to the chancellor having the same standard, and that would be administered by the chair and vice chair of the board. However, if there is any disagreement in terms of the application of those provisions, that there would essentially be a tiebreaker by another member of the board, such as the chair of audit. In this case, I'm saying it would be the chair of audit as drafted. Agreed?
Yes.
I hear it. I hear the consensus.
Or some other designee, because if it's in there that it's absolutely the chair of audit, then...
Right.
Okay.
So, Regent Brooks, for the record, then, Chair. So what would be the agreed upon second committee that we would look at in the case that this would happen? Who would that be so that we can kind of etch that out?
Obviously, it'd be health sciences.
Obviously. You're right. I don't know what I was thinking. I appreciate that, Chair.
That's what business.
I would recommend the business and finance committee.
The chair of business. I think that's reasonable.
They're the most familiar with an area where the chancellor might have committed an infraction and needed to be warned, probably.
So before we jump into 7, let's have a 10-minute break and stretch our legs and come back and we'll pick up 7. I believe, and we're going to look at item 7 and kind of looking at 8. I mean, they're so related. So...
We're ready.
Regent Carvalho.
Oh, no, I'm not ready.
Okay, so committee, I see, Regent Geddes is up there. You guys hear me up in Reno, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so as we're looking at the annual evaluation of presidents, and of course that discussion is certainly going to include, in a way, the periodic evaluation of the presidents, so we can kind of, I think, talk about that together, and clarify if we like it the way it's done right now. I think our previous discussions, I think we've kind of identified that having, well, the way it used to be when Regent Geddes and I were on the board was a regent committee was doing the periodic evaluations of the presidents. And that has since been changed to the current structure where the chancellor appoints a committee, and usually there's maybe an outside consultant. Is that right, Vice Chancellor Abba?
For the record, Crystal Abba, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I can walk you through the current provisions very quickly because I think it might help the committee if they understand what's the difference between an annual evaluation and a periodic evaluation. Okay, so an annual evaluation for the presidents is not unlike annual evaluations that are done for professional employees. They submit kind of a self-evaluation. They answer certain questions. The board handbook is very clear in terms of outlining the criteria in which they are evaluated against, and this board adopted those criteria based on principles that were developed by the AGB. So you'll recall several years ago, those were put in place. So the annual evaluation is done by the chancellor in writing, and there's a discussion between the chancellor and the president. So it's very informal. If there is a recommendation to change any contract provisions, then it goes to the board. But in general, it's a very private process between the chancellor and the president. The periodic evaluation, now that's the biggie. That's the one that basically is done the year prior to the president's contract expiring. And historically, the purpose of that periodic evaluation is so that the board can determine whether or not they want to renew their contract. So in doing so, it is a much more elaborate process that involves a committee that is appointed by the chancellor in consultation with the chair of the board and the president. So the president can suggest members for that. There is a survey tool that is established, and I would consider it where the annual evaluation is more of like a litmus test, kind of how you're doing right now relative to last year, how are you doing right now relative to your goals. This is a deep, deep dive, and it takes several months to do, and it is assisted. The process is assisted with an external entity that is typically presented to the board in an open meeting because pursuant to the open meeting law, an evaluation of a president cannot occur in a closed session. So these items are specifically separated because those processes are the same but different, basically. So item number 7 deals with the annual evaluation and the extent. And again, when the chancellor and I crafted this document, it was based on what we heard at your last meeting. So one of you mentioned the need that the annual evaluation be administered by individuals beyond the chancellor where it is currently administered. So I wouldn't blend these together, Mr. Chairman. I would keep them separate if you don't mind.
I appreciate that. So we will keep them separate for our discussion. The annual evaluation of the president's committee members, do you want to? Let me go Regent Carter, Regent Brooks. Regent Carter.
Chancellor, Chair, and Vice Chair.
And before I go to Regent Brooks, does that raise any open meeting law situation? So you're saying every year the Chancellor, the Chair, and Vice Chair would have this discussion evaluation and come up with a evaluation, okay? Regent Brooks.
Well, I think based on the brevity of Regent Geddes, or sorry, Regent Carter, I thought for a moment that what I would respond with is I'll take evaluation of the presidents for $500, Alex, because of the way that was just described. But I absolutely agree. It should be the chancellor, chair, and vice chair. For number 7.
Okay. Regent Carvalho, please.
I would agree with that as well.
Regent Perkins, I see you kind of sort of agreeing. So some consensus here. Regent Geddes, what are your thoughts?
Concur.
You know what? I agree. That's consensus right there. So we like that one for number 7. And to reiterate, the chancellor, chair, and vice chair conduct annual evaluations of the presidents. Let's go to eight. This is the bigger evaluation, periodic evaluation of the presidents. And Crystal, a question for you is when you said that now we're usually the chancellor is getting an outside consultant at times. It's at the discretion of the chancellor, I believe. Or does the board meet before then and say, it's all the chancellor. And if that outside consultant comes in and they're also, we've used some that are in state, but it's an outside of NSHE. Yeah. And that consultant does interviews, or you have other members of this committee. None of those meetings are public or agendized. They don't need to be.
Right. None are, for the record, Taylor Kiaga, none are public in the way we understand public meeting. They can conduct a town hall with faculty or something like that. The committee divides up an interview list, and the committee interviews stakeholders on a campus.
Okay. And then
one thing I would add, just since I have the microphone and now I'm not going to give it away, just for the committee to understand, the chancellor's periodic evaluation is conducted by a committee of the Board of Regents. Just sit with that for a moment.
Currently.
Mm-hmm.
Currently. So today, the chancellor's evaluation is conducted by a committee of the Regents. The president's periodic evaluation is conducted by a committee with a consultant and the chancellor, and you get a report.
I would rather see us. I'm sorry. I just thinking out loud. Thank you,
Regent Perkins.
I would like to see them be the same, so to avoid a lot of confusion. If the presidents are evaluated, if the chancellor's evaluated a certain way, then the presidents should be evaluated in that same manner.
Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, I do not disagree with that. I just wanted to bring up one logistical issue that a few of us won't have to deal with. Is you have seven presidential evaluations this spring during the legislative session, and getting committees of 4 to 6 regents on seven different committees for an evaluation just might be logistically very difficult, as well as coordinating with our staff. So it may be something to advance, but maybe put an implementation, make it 2024, or later. Just a comment.
Mr. Chair?
Chancellor.
For the record, Dale Urquiaga, thank you, Regent Geddes. So what the regent is referring to is the provision that the periodic evaluation of a president occur in not later than the next to last year of the contract period. If you can tell me what that means with a straight face, I have $5 for you. The way we interpret it is you go back 12 months from the date of the contract expiration, and it has to be done by 12 months. You could say it has to be done by 6 months, and then you would buy yourselves some time, because the regent is correct. Three presidents' contracts expire in June 30 of 2024. One expires August of 2024. One expires September of 2024. One expires October of 2024. There are actually only 6 Regent Geddes. I'm just correcting Regent Geddes left and right today. I'm cruising here.
I appreciate it.
So there are 6 due next year, but that is because of this next to the last year. So you could say no later than 6 months before the 6 months before the expiration. That would allow you to spread them out over a year, should you wish to do so.
Thank you, Chair. Regent Brooks, for the record, I was just going to offer that establishing an ad hoc board committee to conduct the periodic evaluations of the presidents, I think, is a great way to go. And if we decide to do it that way, to Regent Geddes's point, maybe there's some logistical considerations we can have. And to the chancellor's point of spreading that out, because that periodic review process is a little bit vague in that it seems as though it has to be set sometime after 3 years, not to get to 4 years when the contract is to be renewed. So it's like there's this window of almost 12 months based on the way that this is written that we might be able to facilitate something.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, it appears that there is consensus on establishing an ad hoc board committee to conduct the periodic evaluation of the presidents.
Well, I was going to ask that. As I was listening,
that's kind of where I feel like they're at.
I got a little confused. Dale? I didn't sense that. I don't know. So to establish, Regent Carter, is that what you were?
Mind. So I think the presidential process of reviews is underway, being redone, maybe?
For the record, we are on draft 735 right okay. now, and it has been in the works for, and I wish I was joking here, for the last 2 years, and it has not come forward, mostly okay. because at this point of waiting for certain decisions of this board. I do want to point out to the committee that this phrase here is very limited within the context of the overall periodic evaluation process. So the chancellor has had a number of conversations with the Council of Presidents in terms of a number of edits that I would expect that we would bring for these forward in conjunction with this. So this is just dealing with one base issue. It does not deal with the matter of allowing for an external consultant, and often that external consultant is valuable in terms of managing the logistics. So I just want to make sure that you are clear in that to the extent that there is consensus on this, when we bring it back, there's going to be a lot of other details around this, and you'll see the entire periodic evaluation process in writing, which will include these other details. But this just deals with a very narrow little band of saying that the actual evaluation will be conducted by an ad hoc committee of the board, meaning it will be chaired by a member of the board, and it will follow the general handbook provisions that allow for the appointment of members to an ad hoc committee. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and if I could add to the newer members of the board, just from Regent Geddes and I's experience, we did experience that at one time early on, 8 years ago or whatever, and it's a lot of work for a new committee to be formed with a chair of one of us, one of the regents would chair that committee. And then it's agendized, it's open meeting, all that stuff. So I just wanted to share that out there. I mean, I'm comfortable with the current system, but if the committee feels otherwise, Regent Carter.
So in my workings and dealings with trying to change this policy, the not consensus, but the idea that we came up with is really to outsource it to a group that then runs the committee, that takes the chancellor from having that liability. It takes the board members from having to do, you know, six evaluations at the same time. That outside group can talk with each individual regent and not violate the open meeting law, as I understand it. And so that was in my notes and revisions when I was vice chair of the board working on this policy. That's kind of where I was pushing us towards, was actually outsourcing that, not having an ad hoc committee.
I have a question.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you. But could the ad hoc committee also hire an outside consultant to do all that and bring it back to us? I was just asking the question. Okay.
Yeah, I think it could. And my suggestion will be that, I mean, again, because you have to agendize, you have to then send out an RFP to get proposals for a consultant. Maybe if you're an ad hoc committee of the regions, Regent Carter.
Well, along with that same thought, just we were looking down the pipe and we saw this huge bump coming. So we thought, you know, hey, we could just merge all these together, find a firm that can do them all. And we've essentially kept that firm busy for 12 months or whatever, to do all these, you know, evaluations. And then we could do an RFP the next time that comes around or is needed.
Regent Boylan, then Regent Brooks.
Thanks, Chair. I thought it was up to the chair of the board to hire outside consultants, and they could do that on their own, willy-nilly, and, you know, when they thought it was necessary, that the committees couldn't do that, only
well,
the chair.
I think you're accurate with that statement, but I think as a board, we could give that authority to a chair of an ad hoc committee to do a periodic evaluation of a president.
Sounds good. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Let me go, Regent Carvalho, then we'll go Regent Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a lot of questions because, as Vice Chancellor Abba said, this is just such a narrow part of a larger discussion, really. I'm just not sure if establishing an ad hoc committee of the board is the right direction to go in at this time. I think right now I'm more in favor of maintaining what we have with the understanding that this other work that has been going on at the 735th iteration of is something that I'm in support of seeing before we make some other change that I don't know if is the right change at this time, because I think there's a lot of other work going on.
Regent Carter.
My thoughts along the same line. So I think you have this outside group. I think an annual evaluation belongs to the whole board. I don't think it belongs to a subcommittee. I think the whole board hires and fires presidents. The whole board needs to evaluate them.
And periodic evaluation, you were...
This would be, periodic.
Yeah. And I sort of was in agreement with Regent Carvalho that maybe that is the direction to go, but maybe with the potential number of evaluations that have to be done, I don't know if it's more nimble for the administration to keep it as is to get through the next set of evaluations, or they were interested in maybe bringing in outside help.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Vice Chancellor, please.
And I say this as I'm looking at my boss. We have a draft currently that is has been batted to and reviewed by the Council of Presidents a number of times. And it's clear that on annual evaluations, it's easy, okay? I mean, it's autopilot and it's easy. I do think, to Ms. Carvalho's point, it is unfortunate because hindsight is 20/20 vision. And as I sit here crafting this in this manner and limiting it to a narrow band for an issue that is incredibly complex and sensitive to the presidents, obviously I think you want their input as well. With your permission, you may want to consider allowing us to continue the dialogue with the Council of Presidents, because I think we're close, and I'm looking for Dale to nod, and he's not going to give me that guidance.
Dale Urquiaga, for the record, I wouldn't represent that we are close, but I would suggest that we bring you two proposals for this. One, an ad hoc committee of the board. One, the current process as revised by the presidents. Remember, you are not involved in the current periodic process. You get a report. And everything I've heard you say for the last 2 months has been you want to be involved. You're not. You get a report. So I think we should, and under the proposed revisions, you're not. So I think we owe you two pathways here so you can compare and make a decision.
For the record, Regent Brooks, what I'm wondering is, based on the experience that Regent Carter, Regent Geddes, Chair Dubrava have, and based on what the Chancellor just stated, I'm wondering if there's some type of almost middle ground where we have an ad hoc board committee, but that committee can seek guidance from outside consultant firm that comes in and gets things done, because then it feels like maybe the board would still have a stake in what's going on, even though we might be delegating some things to a outside firm. I don't know. Listen, you regents who have been here the longest and are getting ready to exit have gone through this, and so on this one, it's I'd be interested in where you weigh based on the experience that you have and what this actually looks like, so that it's done in best manner for the board as we move forward, because it seems like we don't want to have to come back and revisit this next year. And so we want to be able to outline what this looks like so that the board is a part of this process and best practice measures that it can be, even if that includes the board actually having an implementation of outside consulting.
Regent Perkins, Regent Carter.
I haven't been through this process before, but I will always err on the side of transparency. And with us involved, it becomes more transparent because it follows open meeting law. If we do it in, if we don't do it that way, it can lead to problems that could have been avoided if it had been completely transparent. And that's what I was looking at with the ad hoc committee.
Carter and then Geddes.
So I'll just say, I guess the most important part, at least when I was looking at problem solving this thing, was moving to an outside consultant. The mechanism of it being able to get regent feedback by that outside consultant, whether that report comes back to an ad hoc committee that hires that outside consultant, or whether the full board just RFPs for all of the year, I don't know that that matters as much as having this outside consultant that can then actually talk with the regents without violating any rules or law.
Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I liked Regent Carvalho's and your recommendation. I also like the recommendation from the Chancellor as far as bringing them both back. I just want to go back and stress the logistics of this upcoming year. So we're going to have normally the Chancellor sits in on all of those. And he's going to be in session through June and probably won't have much opportunity to sit in on those. So he could delegate that. But as he said in his opening comments, he's understaffed, and he's trying to get staff, and he's having trouble hiring. And if you talk to Robert and Carrie, we're understaffed. And every single meeting that would be under this subcommittee would have to go through the process of Robert and Carrie and Angela and Winter staffing those meetings, posting those meetings, doing the logistics of setting up the room. It's a lot of work, and they've got to do all that around our normal schedule, and we'll generally have a couple of special sessions or special meetings during legislative sessions. So, I think both recommendations is a good idea, but it's probably best to wait until we get what Crystal's report comes back with. Anyway.
So, Crystal, we heard it from Dale. So if you're going to blame anybody, we want both. Two options, I guess, would go to the meeting in December, just so other regions can weigh in. The presidents would be there to get some input. It's probably the safest thing to do. Item 9. Evaluation criteria.
Absolutely.
I kind of thought this one was a slam dunk almost, if you can say, should annual and periodic evaluation criteria be updated to include measurable goals with targets and metrics for the chancellor and presidents that align with the board's strategic plan and goals?
I think how can you evaluate someone if you don't have measurables or deliverables?
Yeah. And Regent Carvalho?
I echo that 100%.
Regent Carter, I think you're in the affirmative, too, on that. Regent Brooks?
Yes, we're going with that.
On number 9 there.
Yeah, Regent Brooks, for the record. The measurable goals with targets and metrics?
Yes.
We'd want that, yes. I'm in agreement with that.
Regent Geddes, any thoughts on that?
Concur.
So I think there's consensus there. Unanimous consensus. Regent Carter, you want to comment?
Just one thought as the process is kind of being spelled out there, just where these goals come from. Are they generated from the board? Are they generated out of the chancellor's office for the president? Are they generated by the presidents? Like, who's generating these goals?
Regent Brooks, for the record, so I don't know if it helps out at all, but if we take a look at Title I article, right, number 2 is... the cooperation input of presidents, the planning process in terms of what some of this stuff looks like. And I think in there, there's reference to strategic planning and establishing goals and matrix. So I'm wondering if that's an area where where we have a discussion about who's actually setting, you know, these goals and what that looks like.
Yeah, I think that's probably a separate discussion to kind of dial in where those goals come from.
It's a good note. Okay, we'll move on. Termination of presidents. Should board policy be amended to clarify that the chancellor cannot terminate a president? Should the role be further clarified such that a recommendation to terminate a president is part of progressive discipline and a step taken in consultation with the chair and vice chair of the board? So, Vice Chancellor Abba, if you clarify, right now our language is that the I'll let you read it or tell us exactly.
So, for the record, Crystal Abba, currently the board's bylaws, within the provisions that delineate the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor, includes disciplinary action. And I apologize, I'm going to have to read through this because it does include the termination of the president, which does require approval of the board. And I think
if you were continuing to search, which is okay, just from a historical perspective, and again, Regent Geddes is there. I remember being in the community when we had a previous chancellor going back into 2002-ish, 2003, that made a significant change to what it used to be. And I believe it was the board could terminate or had that authority. Whereas the chancellor and the board agreed to this, that was delegated then to the chancellor.
And this item, for the record, Crystal Abba, goes to that confusion that has been with us for some time of who fires the presidents. And for those of you who are aware, going back as far as the Jim Rogers era, there has been some confusion. And so you'll notice this is written very specifically to clarify that the chancellor cannot terminate the presidents, which is the case now, because terminating a president can be a recommendation of the chancellor, but ultimately requires the approval of the board. So what this item simply does is clarifies that the chancellor does not have the authority to terminate. That resides with the board. And again, that's current provision of the handbook, so this simply puts the negative in there to help clarify perceptions, if that makes sense.
Regent Carter.
I'll just say I like the wording, a recommendation to terminate must include consultation with the chair and vice chair of the board. So it leaves the termination with the board, I guess, like insider baseball-wise, but logistically at the point where there's a recommendation to terminate, is that when, like, the inside stuff happens and you, like, present that to the president, or do they have to wait until, like, an open meeting? Or, I mean, is that too in the woods, in the weeds?
Well, good questions. And if I could throw another question onto that, it's a recommendation to terminate must include consultation. The word consultation I don't like at all. I want there to be, does that mean agreement has to be achieved between the chancellor and the chair and vice chair before then that recommendation goes to the full board? Or are we okay with that? Because believe me, there has been times when there's been a consultation with a committee chair, and the committee chair did not agree with what was going to happen, and the chancellor had the ultimate authority, and then you present, like, well, wait, if someone's an elected regent and they do not agree with what's happening, the chancellor actually superseded the authority. And that happened years ago.
Mr. Chairman, just for the sake of clarification for the record, Crystal Abba, these items are intended to layer on each other the way they're crafted in this document. So the first issue is, do you want to clarify that the chancellor cannot terminate the president? Assuming the answer to that is yes, then do you want to further clarify that any recommendation by the chancellor to terminate is part of the progressive discipline provisions? And then another layer on that. So if you're not going to do the first one, you're not going to do the others.
Okay, so jump ahead too fast.
Sense? I apologize. That's not clear.
Yeah, okay. So, I think maybe from what I'm hearing, I think this committee at least clarified that the chancellor cannot terminate a president. And if anyone disagrees, I think we're all on the same page on that one. So then the second one, I think the committee consensus clarified that termination is a step in progressive discipline.
Mm-hmm. And to make that clear, that means if you don't do progressive, you've got to do progressive discipline first. Mm-hmm. So you don't just recommend termination out of
unless there was something egregious. I thought there was a that's in the current policy.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So we're both, I think we're all in agreement on the first two. So now it's a recommendation to terminate. And that recommendation is only initiated by the chancellor, if I'm reading this multiple ways. And it must include, oh, I'm telling the chair and vice chair that I'm recommending termination. Or do we want that the chancellor to say, I'm recommending termination. I need either the chair or the vice chair to agree with me.
And in practicality, that gives the chair and vice chair the opportunity to stop that action. Okay, because otherwise the chancellor can bring it forward through that progressive discipline process. Because you're consulting with the chair and vice chair, if they don't agree with you, it stops there.
I don't think it's just, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I've been just blurting out stuff. I don't think it should be able to be stopped right there. I think it should come to the full board. The recommendation should always come to the full board, not be stopped in the mid-process. That's okay.
Okay. Council Kilroy.
Thank you. From Merriam-Webster Dictionary, in consultation with is an idiom after having a discussion with.
So the consultation is, as long as there's a discussion, doesn't mean it has to be agreement. Yeah.
Regent Brooks, for the record. So it seems as though the way that that's laid out is it's almost giving notice to the chair and vice chair that, hey, I'm going to bring this forward. I'd like to be part of an agenda item. The board is going to recognize that this is going on because it's on the agenda, and any communications that then might take place between legal counsel and the board regarding termination processes. Is that correct? So that the board would get full notification even if the initial process begins with the chair and vice chair as just the chancellor's notifying those two bodies to let them know what's happening.
Good question. Council Martinez.
Yeah, Jimmy Martinez for the record. That's correct. What you're really talking about here is access to the agenda. So the chancellor makes the recommendation to the chair and vice chair. If the chair and vice chair disagree, ultimately what you're talking about is them blocking access to put that on the agenda. If it does make it to the agenda, then you have it come before the full board and a full discussion. And even at that point, the vice chair and the chair can change their mind during the open discussion. But ultimately, it's going to take full board action.
It's going to take full board action to terminate a president.
Terminate, correct, because the board is the appointing authority.
I guess Perkins. I'm just a little bit leery, Laura Perkins for the record, about consultation. Maybe made aware of or some others a little bit, something just a little bit strong, clearer, so that the vice chair and chair have to be made aware or something along those lines, as opposed to consultation. Because consultation makes it sound like it's a group and they're consulting each other and they're going to come to something.
Notified.
Notify. That's
perfect. And I throw that word out there for your explanation. I'm not necessarily in favor of that.
Right.
You know, Regent Boylan.
Oh, I think he was ahead of me. Regent Brooks?
Yeah, go ahead, Regent.
All right. Thank you, sir. Now, if the chair, like Council Jimmy said, Martinez, said that the chair and the vice chair would put it on the agenda, and let's say for some reason they don't want to put it on the agenda, I know that there could be three other regents that could ask for it to be put on the agenda. So it would still, so then how does the president get fired? Nobody wants to put it on the agenda. It doesn't go to the board. The board doesn't get to make a choice. Help me.
Yeah, there's a lot of subtleties here about creation of agenda, who has the ultimate authority to terminate a president, and then how much authority are we taking back, maybe from the chancellor role. Regent Geddes, call a friend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a reminder, this is after progressive discipline. So, you know, the chair and vice chair are meeting with the chancellor once a week. And if there's issues with the president and they start going through progressive discipline, it wouldn't be till you hit the point of recommending termination where you'd be talking about accessing the agenda and putting it on the agenda. And to Regent Boylan's point, it wouldn't be public. So three regents couldn't ask for it because they wouldn't know about the first two discipline steps. That would be just the chair and vice chair at that point with the chancellor. So those first few steps are taken internally. If it comes to the point of recommending termination, it needs to go there. And I'm fine with the language change. I've always read it differently, and I've always emphasized the point that we're the hiring and firing authority, as Jimmy pointed out, and not the chancellor. The chancellor can only recommend. So.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
I'm sorry, Regent Carter.
So how about a recommendation to terminate must include the consent of the chair or vice chair of the board?
Prior to it going to the full
prior
board.
Prior to going to the full board. So either the chair or the vice chair has to agree with the chancellor that the person should be terminated before it goes to the board.
And I think, I can't speak for the president, but I think any that's one safety mechanism or at least one appeal to say, oh, the chancellor has kind of notified that president that their intent is to recommend termination. But if a chair or vice chair says, no, I don't agree with that, it stops that process. Vice Chancellor Abbott, and then we'll go Regent Boyd.
If I may, I think where we got off track here was with the Webster's definition of consultation. So historically, as Jimmy indicated, that term has been used when it says in consultation. It is consent. So at that point in time, following progressive discipline, if the chancellor makes the recommendation in consultation with the chair and vice chair, if they don't agree, it doesn't go forward.
With all due respect.
So if you use the term consent, it's essentially the same as it's written here. And consent, quite frankly, is clearer, I think, for the purpose of a layman reading this. But I just wanted to make sure that that's clear, because I think that's where we kind of got a little bit hung up. And I want to make sure that we're...
Yeah, and I'd be really comfortable if we did change it to include consent with the chair and vice chair. Are you saying, oh, now if there's one person that... Oh, then we are getting into wordsmithing, but yeah. Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. Regent Geddes made a salient point, then that comes back to what I was saying. And I think what Regent Perkins is saying, it should be a committee, not just a chair and a vice chair, because if they don't tell us, which has happened quite a lot in a bunch of things since I've been on this board, we don't know this is happening with the chancellor and a certain president. This is not going to go anywhere, and I think that's too much power given to the chair and the vice chair. I think it should go to a committee or a subcommittee. They must be informed so that we can have three regents who would say, okay, this chair and this vice chair like this president, they don't want to get rid of him, her, or whatever. So let's us go around that and bring it on the agenda. I don't understand. It was a salient point he made, and he's got his hand up. Peace to you also.
Okay. I'll let
Regent Geddes and Regent Brooks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to point out, we elect the chair and vice chair. I mean, so it is the 13 of us who pick the chair and vice chair. So they are representatives to the chancellor and to this process. And there are issues that come up with the presidents that you can't notify the whole board about. Ideally, the chancellor with the chair and vice chair as our representatives can address the issue internally. But if it escalates through the progressive discipline, then it will come to the full board. We will have a full discussion, and we will all be part of that discussion and that vote, except for me, because I won't be here anymore. So good luck with that, guys.
Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. Regent Brooks, for the record. So, Regent Geddes, I guess the question that I have based on what you just said, when we're talking about progressive discipline and that this would essentially come to the board anyhow, and board members would then make that decision to terminate or not, does that add to or negate if we were just to do a blanket, you know, consensus on number 10, where the recommendation to terminate is, you know, notice it, if you will, is provided to the chair and vice chair, and we just leave it at that.
I think that's kind of how we have it. How many steps are in progressive discipline now, Crystal? Is it the three, as you mentioned? It's verbal, written, and then it would go to the board?
Yes.
General Counsel Martinez.
Jimmy Martinez, for the record. And I would actually recommend, just having done this for years, that you not add language that makes progressive discipline rigorous, that it's required to go, because depending on the severity of the infraction, it makes sense to skip to the appropriate progressive discipline step.
Regent Brooks, for the record. So what would that look like specifically if we're taking a look at how it should be written?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record. It would look like, and we have language in other places when we reference progressive discipline, and it would be permissive language that allows the chancellor, in consultation with the chair and vice chair, to apply, I don't know the exact language it would be at this time, but they would be allowed to apply different levels of progressive discipline as appropriate for the level of infraction, if that makes sense. So if there's a list of prohibited activity, for instance, and, you know, obviously they're less severe and more severe, you know, one being the least, and then it goes all the way to five. If they have a four, maybe it's not just a, you know, an oral warning. Maybe then it's a written reprimand, just to sufficiently address the level of insubordination or whatever it happens to be.
Chancellor.
For the record, Dale Urquiaga. So just to build, I think, on what Executive Vice Chancellor Abba and General Counsel Martinez have said, the existing language says the chancellor may take any of the following disciplinary actions for cause against the president. One, issue a warning. Two, issue an oral or written reprimand. Three, this one is just written badly. It says remove from office and terminate employment contract with approval of the board. I would say they should read one, issue a warning. Two, issue an oral or written reprimand. Three, recommend the board terminate the president's contract. And then there is language, the next sentence says, any disciplinary action shall only be taken in consultation with the chair of the board. That's current. You could add chair and vice chair if you wish to broaden that. But I think what's caused this hiccup is the way this sentence says remove from office and terminate the employment contract with approval of the board. Flip the sentence around and say recommend that the board terminate the president's contract. Just be clear. All the chancellor can do is recommend that.
Yeah, Regent Brooks, for the record, I think that's probably a great way to go in terms of the way we're looking at this. Otherwise, we might scrutinize some of the words, how they're strung together, and what the meaning could be interpreted to be. So it's probably better that we have something very exact.
I think we had some consensus with what the chancellor just said, Vice Chancellor Abba. We know on that subtle point, well, not subtle, clarify that the chancellor cannot terminate a president, clarify that the termination is a step in progressive discipline still, because progressive discipline gives the chancellor the ability to go from whatever step he or she deems appropriate based on the infraction. And now, however the chancellor said it for the final.
For our sake, Mr. Chair, this is Dale Urquiaga, for the record. Do you wish it to be in consultation with the chair and vice chair? Do you wish it to be consent of the chair or vice chair? Just give us some feel here. I don't have an opinion.
I'll be off the board. I think it does offer some protection of checks and balances if you say with consent of either the chair or vice chair. Yeah. That's just one other person that's, okay, is this, you know, do we have a, well, I won't even go into hypotheticals, but that's my suggestion. And I think everyone's okay with that. Crystal, you okay?
No, I just saw some nodding heads over here. Noes.
Oh.
I guess I'm hung up on consent. Consent means that they don't have to put it on the agenda? Or consent just means...
My understanding is that if a chancellor wanted to proceed with this type of action, a recommendation to terminate, then that recommendation to terminate at least needs the consent or agreement of either the chair of the board or the vice chair of the board, and then it goes forward to go to the full board. If he or she doesn't get consent of either chair or vice chair, there's no termination of the president. And the chancellor then has to go to plan B or...
Okay, but the recommendation still has to go to the board for a vote or a discussion?
The vote to terminate.
The vote to terminate.
Well, yeah, if it makes it that far, right? Is that where we're getting hung up on?
Yeah, so the chair and vice chair have the ability to say no to the termination.
But if one of them says yes, and it's in agreement with the chancellor, it goes forward. So you don't need a unanimous agreement. The chancellor might need just consent of the chair or the vice chair. Regent Carter.
I'll just add, so right now it's only the chair. So if the chair didn't want to do it, it wouldn't move forward. So we add the vice chair in there. That's at least two other of our representatives, you know, looking at it.
It's putting, in my opinion, it's a check on the chancellor to make sure that a chancellor hasn't gone off the rails and says, well, guess what? I'm going to recommend that this president be terminated, regardless with the chair and vice chair thing. And then it's all, then it goes public and it's a...
Then it goes public and there's 13 votes on it.
Yeah. Now, if it goes forward, there's going to be the full board weighs in. Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am not comfortable with the situation. I think it has to be the chair and the vice chair with the chancellor making that recommendation. I mean, if we have two regents who don't agree on it internally, I can't imagine how that's going to look when the 13 of us are discussing it. So I'm not comfortable with the or. I'd much rather have an and. If the board is going to go with an or, I would like Jimmy or somebody else to put together some language to justify why, you know, if the vice chair got with the chancellor and they overruled the chair, why? I would just like some sort of documentation process if they don't agree, but I prefer that all three of them agree. Because if all three of them don't agree, it's you've been in at least one of these. It gets messy.
Regent Geddes, I really do appreciate what you said. And you and I, we've seen so many different scenarios that I'm comfortable saying, yeah, it has to be the chancellor and chair and vice chair in unison saying we need to go forward with this termination process.
I have a question.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate your patience, me not being on this board, but just a suggestion, because I think I'm getting a bit confused again. I think why does the Chancellor should have the power to bring it to the board? Why do we have to ask the Chair and Vice Chair? Just bring it straight to the board. If eventually the board is going to make that decision, why should we be stymied by a chair and vice chair who both say, no, we don't want to get rid of this person. See what I'm saying? We're getting too much power to the chair and vice chair. They may be friends. They may be friends with the president. You know, bring it straight to the board. Yeah. That's what we were elected for.
And my suggestion is you're adding just one more step to it to do a checks and balance against the chancellor.
I would take that step away. The less steps you have in any process, the better it is. Just go straight for the throat and say, bada bang, are we doing this or not?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I didn't put this on and I didn't ask your permission.
Huh? That's all right. Mr. Kilroy.
Thank you. A suggestion and two questions I have, seeking clarification. If it's the intent of the system and the regents to use in consultation with, then I would recommend we define what that means. I understand what it's been used in the past, but an ordinary person reading it would be, a discussion with, because that's how it's defined. And then secondly, my questions have to do about, are we, because it seems muddy to me, are we with the recommendation to terminate with the chair and vice chair, are we simply presuming that if they consent that they are in agreement with the termination, or are we determining whether or not it gets placed on the agenda as to the point of Regent Boylan, but at the same time trying to seek clarification with the GERD consultation and then find out exactly what the end game is for this recommendation. Thank you.
Also good questions. I was interpreting it as that the chair and vice chair were in agreement that that's the proper next step of discipline is to go with a recommendation of termination. But what you've raised is subtle. Okay, they may not be in agreement, but they're going to agree to put it to the full board agenda.
Exactly, like a second to a motion.
Yeah, so it gets a little confusing. General Martinez, Council Martinez is going to clear it up.
Jimmy Martinez for the record. One of the things from a legal standpoint that we always like to see with a process that requires something like the chancellor having to consult with the chair and vice chair is what you're doing is you're further vetting the process before bringing something into the public realm. If it is not appropriately vetted, it could end up opening the system to more liability at that point. So it's just something to keep in mind that, you know, when these types of things go through more vetting processes and, you know, with professional faculty and you know, faculty at the institutions, we have investigations. If this isn't a full investigation, this would be a process that allows something like that.
Regent Carter, thank you.
Just to kind of clarify and build on what people are responding to Regent Boylan. So in the way it works in our handbook, the chair has to approve the agenda. So in essence, for the chancellor to get that on the agenda, it would still have to go through the chair. So the question is, I guess, whether you want the chair and the vice chair or the chair or the vice chair. And I would like us not to get hung up on that and move on.
Well, and I'm going to go to Regent Geddes next, but I thought there was if the chair doesn't, the chancellor has the authority to put something on the agenda. Not at all?
No.
Okay, I stand corrected. Okay, Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jimmy and Patrick covered what I was going to say, so.
Then, at least with the committee members, respectfully with what Regent Boylan has said, I think with the committee members, there is some consensus. We can vote if we want. Regent Carter.
I was going to suggest someone choose one and we'll vote and see what we have.
Okay. Okay. I was going to suggest if someone wants to make a motion to say must include consent of the chair and vice chair of the board.
So moved.
So moved. From Regent Geddes. Do I have a second for that?
I'll second it. This is Regent Brooks.
Regent Brooks. So it's going to be the chancellor, and the consent of the chair and vice chair to proceed with the recommendation to terminate a president. All those in favor on the committee say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
Regent Perkins with nay. I think that carries. Motion carries. Vice Chancellor Abbott, do you have a question?
No, just wanted to clarify. So we're going with the first box, the second box, the revision to the third box where we say consent with the chair and vice chair, and the recommendation of the chancellor to flip number three so that it indicates terminate with the approval of the board, and you're essentially removing the remove from office language. Okay. Thank you.
We're going to number 11 here, closed personnel sessions. Should legislation be sought during the 2023 session of the Nevada State Legislature to amend the state's open meeting law to provide that personnel session of the chancellor and presidents can be held in closed session? And again, from previous meetings that we've had in public, I think that's also a consensus that it's something we'd want to see if we could pursue that. And again, we make our argument, and then there's the opposing camp, whether it be the press association or other camps for legitimate reasons. They're like, well, no, they want full transparency, but we're willing to present our case again. Regent Carter.
I just have one thought I'd want to add to that. But so on the evaluations, I think that's one thing, and maybe those still probably should be public, but I think the opportunity as a board to have feedback sessions either at that annual evaluation or whenever we think that we need it or the chancellor brings something to our attention, I think that's where these closed sessions will prove most useful. So rather than having to wait until an annual evaluation or a periodic evaluation, we can meet as a board and provide our feedback in a closed session that doesn't put the president in some sort of odd environment to receive just feedback, not an evaluation.
Good point. Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's actually to Mr. Kilroy. In the past, your position, has had a seat at the Attorney General's Office committee where they have a committee that reviews the OML and brings changes to the legislature, and really going with the Attorney General and that office in a more comprehensive bill as opposed to us with a standalone bill might be the better way to go. And I was just curious if you've been able to serve on that committee yet or if you've got any feedback from there.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I have read that in the past, and as that the special general counsel is a member of the AG's committee. I will be proactive in reaching out to the representatives of the AG's office and see how soon I can get involved with that.
Thank you very much.
Regent Brooks, for the record, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to offer that, under Chapter 6, faculty already has the luxury, I guess, or the opportunity to have a closed personnel session. And maybe that's something that could be presented to the legislative body in terms of why we're asking for this, because if faculty already has the opportunity to have a closed session, there's no reason why our chancellor and presidents shouldn't share that same opportunity during a personnel session.
Thanks for those comments. So just make a bill, right? That will kind of be a process, I'm sure. Chancellor.
Yes, for the record, Dale Arquiaga. So I am greatly relieved that Regent Geddes knew of this committee and that Chief of Staff Kilroy can talk with them, because you will recall, she has no ability to request a bill draft. And so absent that committee discussing this and making a recommendation in what will no doubt be a cleanup open meeting law bill, which probably happens every session, we will be scurrying around the halls with an amendment in our hands, waiting for somebody to open that chapter or title and then hijacking someone else's bill. Or I will be asking one of 63 legislators to do this, to give us, quote, something special that school districts, counties, and cities don't have, At the same time, I'm asking them to approve our budget. So I appreciate having another avenue for this conversation to move forward.
Sounds good. Thank you. Item 12 was sort of that open one. And again, we're in the committee agenda item 4 of this roles and responsibilities. So if there's not a comment here, we can come back to it, or even when we start looking at our next group of questions, the Title I, Article 7, Section 3. So I think we'll move on. So now we have discussed specific amendments to the responsibilities of the Chancellor, outlined in Title I, Article 7, Section 3. Number one, to promote a sound plan of organization in concert with the institutional presidents to ensure administrative efficiency, maximum utilization of resources, and to facilitate cooperation among the member institutions.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps some background.
Please.
If I may. For the record, Crystal Abba, Executive Vice Chancellor. So the provisions of Title I, Article 7, Section 3, these explicitly appear in the employment contract. So when the employment contract for the Chancellor comes before the board, among the provisions that it outlines in terms of termination and other criteria, it says this is your job. There is language in there. So each of these items is delineated. So we pulled these out individually so that you look at each one. The last item, of course, is the discipline of the presidents, which we've already discussed. So if you want to go through these individually, you can decide if you want to retain them. And at the end, you can also decide if you want to add other items. For example, the big one that seems to be missing from this is the role of the chancellor in terms of the development and approval of academic programs, which is, of course, key to the system.
With that being said, do we have direction from the committee regarding this? Number one, do you want to keep it? Do you want to revise it? Without getting, well, Regent Brooks, if you
Regent Brooks, for the record. So on that one, the sound plan of organization, I would offer to retain it so that there's a plan of organization process. And I hate to do this, Chair, and if it's not acceptable, then we can just move on. But because you had made reference that we can come back to something mm-hmm. that might not have been spoken about, right,
yes.
during this
yes.
process. And my note is the role of student academic affairs inside the handbook in terms of what that looks like. And while we're going through and defining what some of these roles are, that maybe there's an opportunity to place something in there specifically for student and academic affairs, particularly I'm referring to the officer. So that person, what do they do? How do they interact with the board? How do they set things in motion to support student effort?
Mr. Chairman, that's included in item number 15 as a checkbox. So you can check that box on number 15 if you would.
Okay.
When we get there, Byron, you're ahead of us,
all
as
right.
usual.
Great. Thanks.
Like that. So
appreciate
we'll
it. Right. Sorry about that, Chair. But yeah, so in terms of where we are right now, yes, I would say let's retain that.
Number one, if everyone's in agreement, I think we are. Regent Geddes, how are you with item one here? Looks good. Okay. So consensus, yes, retain. Number two, to be responsible with the full cooperation and input of the presidents for the planning process of the Nevada System of Higher Education. And I think Vice Chancellor.
Background, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Crystal Abba. So that term planning processes is an old term that has been in the handbook for as long as I have been here, and it is a bit nebulous. So planning processes can mean anything. It can mean the strategic planning processes. It can mean academic program planning processes. So the issue here is to, if you select item box 3, would be essentially to revise that provision to indicate that it's strategic planning processes.
I see. So that revision is there, and that appeals to me. Yep. I see.
You read
some,
my mind.
Yeah, I see some affirmative nods there, Regent Brooks, on that. Kind of revising that to strategic planning.
Thank you, Chair Regent Brooks, for the record. So when I looked at it, it was to revise it as you're speaking about now, but it was also to clarify, because sometimes when we talk about strategic planning, right, there seems to be two different lanes that we're typically driving in. There's the strategic planning of what we have with the institutions in terms of those metrics of goals for student experience, achievement, right, capital. And then there's strategic planning when it comes specifically to the systems office. And that I would offer is something a little bit different because we're talking about administrative strategy and planning, right? So, for instance, are all of the campuses, when we take a look at this, is hiring the same across the board for the state of Nevada regarding employment at our higher education institutions? Is technology implementation the same? So student transfers, are dual credits looked at the same across the board in terms of some of our institutions? And so it feels like there should be part of this planning process when we're talking about implementation should be what we're looking at in terms of the five goals that we all know of that the institutions have and have been working on, right, in terms of that strategic planning, and then more of like this administrative process of planning to keep everyone on the same page to ensure that there's at least some uniformity to how things are happening, particularly hiring processes and anything that has to do with, again, I think the easiest examples are credits, students. What does that look like from an admin process?
So are you suggesting to revise, we keep this revision to include reference to strategic planning and established metrics to measure progress towards established board goals, and what further language would you?
Well, I'd leave that open for board discussion in terms of what it means if we have strategic goals that are set for institutions and then administrative goals that are meant to support the institutions. I don't believe that one size fits all when we take a look at education across the board, right? But there has to be some, you know, hiring processes that are the same. That's what I would offer, just to open up the conversation.
Regent Carter.
So I guess I see that as being fine as it's written, but I think there needs to be another section, and maybe this is where Brooks is going, that, you know, there's two roles to the job of chancellor, or at least two roles. One is running this office, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot about running this office in the goals here or the objectives of serving that. Most of it's written towards like working with presidents and having institutional goals or system-wide goals there. So maybe there needs to be another bullet point for that. Is that what I'm hearing, kind of?
Regent Brooks, for the record, it is, because we're talking, we keep having the conversation about what are our identified tasks, roles, responsibilities of individuals. And so if we're going to take a look at what this looks like from a strategic plan for the system, I would invite that the strategic plan for the system from an administrative standpoint is going to be different than what one of our higher education institutions are doing. They're two separate entities. And so there should be some type of strategic planning that happens with the system office outside of what our institutions are already doing. And, you know, I bring this up, Regent Carter, because we had conversation about this in a meeting when we were at DRI and we were being presented with what looked like some strategic plans. And I got a little bit, I was trying to figure out how are the plans of the system office interwoven with the plans of the universities, and that they should be meshed together, right? And so the only way that I can see that they would be meshed together is recognizing there's two different lanes here, an administrative lane and then the goals of achievement that universities are looking at.
So I'm hearing the word alignment. And so maybe the word, so what I hear is that the institutions are making all these plans. These plans get passed up to us, but those plans aren't collated or aligned or put into a master plan here. Is that kind of?
Well, Regent Brooks, for the record, so all I'm offering is we have the five plans for strategy goals for higher education, right? Increase access, improve student success. Those are things that happen at the institutions, right? But what might be helpful for those in the system office and the new chancellor as somebody comes in down the road are what could be the metrics and definition of strategy and goals for the system office, right? That would be different than what we have for the institutions, because I don't know necessarily, unless the system office is supporting the institution in some type of administrative process for student success, right? We have a different lane in which the system office is working from an administrative perspective, where student engagement, enrollment, recruitment, all of that's coming from the institutions. And so they're two different things, but they should be maybe in supportive of, or just making sure, so the system office then would make sure that the institutions, if we're talking about enrollment or, you know, fund, things that would make sense for the institution. I guess that's what I can offer.
Let's see if the chancellor wants to weigh in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dale Urquiaga. So let me try here. So I think what I am hearing is, one, you could revise item number 2 so that it says to be responsible with the full cooperation and input of the presidents for the strategic planning processes of the INSHE to include establishing metrics to measure progress towards established board goals. That's kind of how we do it today in practice. You've set goals, they set plans. Then you would add a new section to this list of duties that says to be responsible for the development of a plan and goals for the system office. That is different from that consultation with the president. I think that's the best that I can, and that would include the kinds of things that you've mentioned, but I wouldn't include those things here. This is a list, this is a job description. So even part of my job description is work with the presidents on strategic planning against the goals the board sets, and then part of my job is establish a strategic plan to run this place.
Regent Burks, for the record, yes, I'm in full agreement with the chancellor in the way that he's looking at it and the way that I'm describing it. So, yes.
Okay. And I think that language is accepted amongst the committee members, as I'm seeing.
Perhaps not run this place. We'll come up with something a little more eloquent than
that. And I got the Vice Chancellor Abbott gave me the thumbs up, so we're good with the consensus on that. So we're going to revise with the mentioned statements. We can go to 3. To prepare in collaboration with the board chair and the committee chairs the agenda of all meetings of the Board of Regents and its committees. So Regent Perkins mentioned retain, and then Regent Carter.
So prepare, for me, I guess, means what our staff is doing as far as putting the agendas together. But I think, you know, the chancellor is involved with crafting the agenda items, but I don't know that the preparation, maybe it's just wordsmithing in the way I'm reading it, belongs to the system staff.
For the record, this is Dale Urquiaga. I think you can delete this one. This is not my job. This is the board's job, board staff's job. Mm-hmm. My job is to provide a briefing paper, or I've requested agenda items, but this is actually no longer the chancellor's job. This is old language from before when the chancellor was secretary to the board.
So, Regent Perkins, does that kind of change what you were thinking?
It does, because I was thinking help craft. I was actually thinking help craft the agendas, but I guess that's not the chancellor's job at all. So, okay, I say delete.
I think delete is what we want to do here. Yeah, Regent Geddes and Regent Brooks. Regent Geddes. I see.
I'm fine with deleting the language. I just want to make sure that our staff, the board staff, and the chancellor's staff are coordinating all the way through the process. And I think they're doing that. And this doesn't help it one way or the other. So.
Regent Brooks. Regent Brooks, for the record. Thank you, Chair. I was just going to offer that the Chief of Staff does this with the board chair. And then, obviously, presidents and the chancellor can make requests for agenda items. And I don't think that will change. But I believe the chancellor is correct in saying that this is probably one of those things that are outdated and doesn't fall under the responsibility of the chancellor.
Okay. Consensus there to delete that one. Number four, to be responsible for the presentation of all Enchi matters to the governor's office and the state legislature.
Regent Brooks, for the record, I'm going to say retain.
We have a retain. I think we see Regent Perkins with retain.
I'm
fine. Go ahead, Regent Carter.
I'm fine retaining. I thought he was turning it on. I was about to say something.
And I think retain also. And Regent Carvalho, I see a positive there. Regent Geddes, I think we're going to retain. Thumbs up. Okay, retain. We're making progress. Number five, to be responsible in collaboration with the board chair for official communication on behalf of the Board of Regents.
Regent Brooks, for the record. Thank you, Chair. So what I would offer is this is something different than what Chair of the Board McAdoo was speaking about earlier when she was talking about messaging and social media. I think this is something that has more to do with public statements that are being made, and that should absolutely be in collaboration with the board chair. And so I would offer to retain this. And I don't know if there's any other language that needs to be added to this so that it I wonder if must collaborate. You know, I'm not really sure, but I do know what we'd like to see is a better manner in communication regarding public statements that are being made or statements that are being drafted maybe to somebody at the governor's office where the board chair understands and is looking at it and knows what is happening prior to it happening so that nothing is a surprise.
And before I go to Regent Perkins, Regent Brooks, were you maybe thinking to be responsible instead of in collaboration with the board chair? And these are maybe your thoughts, approval by the board chair of official communications?
I wonder if, I don't know if approval is the correct terminology as much as there, maybe it, I guess what I'm looking for is that there must be collaboration with that board chair before this messaging is pushed out.
And maybe some scenario that I think I've seen and others have seen in the past, going back years, whatever, is maybe the chancellor and on behalf of Enchi is making a public statement regarding any possible social issue that's out there in our world, and there's so many of them, whereas that might not sit well with the board for whatever reason. And I think that's where there's potential conflict with communications going out through the office. So
yeah, and I would, again, Regent Brooks, for the record, I'm interested in the chancellor's thoughts on this so that we're not limiting the chancellor's ability to communicate effectively, particularly when we're dealing with legislative issues. And the governor's office, but at the same time, having some type of the word is right there, collaboration with the board chair.
Okay.
Okay. So for the record, this is Dale Arquiaga. So, like, you can't make a policy that people play nice. Like, let me just say that. I realize you've all had a bad experience. So some of this, you can't wordsmith this hard, folks. The best I can offer for you is to, rather than to be responsible in collaboration with the board chair, which is just bad grammar, you may wish to say to collaborate with the board chair for official communication on behalf of the regents. Like, but you can't say, you must collaborate. Like, really, really, we mean it. Be nicer to each other. Like, I get it. You had a bad experience, but like, you can't write that into a job description.
Fair. Regent Brooks, for the record, fair enough.
I think you could say to collaborate is the job.
Sure. That's the task of the chancellor, to collaborate with the board chair regarding this type of messaging. Yeah.
That's the best I can give you.
Okay.
Regent Carter.
So is there also a distinction between being responsible in collaboration with the board chair for official communications on behalf of Enchi, or is Enchi you're able to, the chancellor is able to communicate whatever on behalf of Vinci, but they can't say, oh, this is on behalf of Vinci, but not the board. Like, is there a distinction, or can we clarify that?
I'm sure somebody would make a distinction that I'm not smart enough to have thought. So, yes, you could say to collaborate with the board chair for official communication on behalf of the Board of Regents and the Nevada System of Higher Education. So that way I don't take a position on the war in Ukraine and say I'm doing that as Inchi and I'm not doing that for the board. So I think you're right at it.
I think that helps clarify and keeps everyone, this is what it says. Okay. Regent Geddes, what do you think?
Yeah, and it seems like we're hopping between 4 and 5, which is okay. And I don't know if this is the place to put it. As you know, our policy in the past has always been if the board has taken a position, that's the position that the chancellor takes to the governor and to the legislature. But if we haven't taken a position, then it's up to his judgment based on what's happening to make a call and then report it back to us. So I want to make sure, especially in the legislative side of it, that we're not handcuffing him because those things move very fast, as Sarah Spuler would put it.
Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, I just want to clarify, and this kind of reiterates what the Chancellor just said. This is a job description. This is not policy. Okay, we actually have a policy on that establishes very clear authority on what the chancellor can and cannot do with respect to representing the system office. Totally separate section of the handbook. This appears in the employment contract. It is intended to be general statements that set the expectations for the roles of the chancellor. General. So I think what's happening here is you're trying to put policy in when this isn't the place for policy. I'll say it again. Job description.
Point well made.
And now that Dale's beat me down, I'm glad Crystal did too.
Well, it doesn't hurt to have reiterate to be in concert with both.
Thank you, Mr.
Regent Boylan.
Thanks, Chair. Just a quick suggestion here: the one word that we were having issues with, consultation. Maybe that could be in consultation with the board chair. Just a wee bit of a word here. That's also.
Appreciate that. And then with the chancellor saying to collaborate with, I mean, I think we're okay with that. Regent Carter?
So we're doing the to collaborate with, and we're adding the Nevada System of Higher Education.
That's my understanding,
I'll make
yes.
that motion if you want to take that as a motion. Or
we have a motion.
Regent Brooks, I'll second it.
We have a second. All the committee members in favor of that, please say aye.
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 Any committee members opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. So we are on number 6, to establish the practices under which the financial administration of the Nevada System for Education will be conducted. Again, that's in the job description, as Vice Chancellor Abba pointed out. So we're going to leave that role. We have that option to leave that role with the chancellor.
Regent Brooks, for the record, I'm going to offer that it should be revised to include exactly how it's written, activities such as coordination, development, and presentation of the system budget.
And was that a motion, sir?
Regent Brooks, for the record, I was opening that up for discussion, but I'm happy to make a motion if you think we could just fire that right off.
I think we can do that as a motion, and we have a second from Regent Carvalho. I think we're comfortable with that. All committee members in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That carries.
That was the revise, right? Sorry, I went to a different
place.
Yeah,
revise, as written.
It was a reprieve. It was nice. I'm back now.
Number 7, to assure that all budgets are executed in accordance with the intent of the Board of Regents and the legislature. I think that one's pretty good to retain.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good with that.
We're going to retain that one. That's by consensus. Number 8. To serve as contracting officer for the Nevada System of Higher Education and to execute all contracts and other instruments on behalf of the university unless authority has been expressly retained by the Board of Regents or delegated elsewhere.
I would go with the, Mr. Chair, Laura Perkins for the record, amend the handbook to include a quarterly, quarterly reporting on all contracts signed and executed.
And for clarification, Mr. Chairman, this will not be in this section because it's not part of the job description. This would establish a policy separately in the handbook where you have other reporting requirements, probably Chapter 10, where it has all your budget and finance and contract-related provisions.
I think we're good with the amendment there on consensus. Regent Carter.
Quick question. Maybe this is a legal question, I guess. Other instruments on behalf of the university, what does that mean? Like, is university other places in the contract?
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, I actually made a note of that. So the university is the constitutional name. NRS 396 then creates the Board of Regents, or establishes that the Board of Regents establishes their duties and then establishes the Nevada system of higher education. So it could be worded clearer, but I think you can just task us to work on that language as we bring it back.
Okay, and so that was eight. Do I need to do my consensus or a motion? I kind of went where Vice Chancellor Abba was a moment ago.
Regent Brooks, for the record, I think we're all in agreement with the amendment to include the quarterly reporting.
I agree. I think that is, with a little extra wordsmithing by General Counsel and Vice Chancellor Abba.
Technical changes.
Got it. And so that is consensus for the amendment. And Vice Chancellor Abba, am I correct then that 9, 10, all the others are not necessarily in the job description of Chancellor?
No, these are also in the the same section, so keep going.
Okay. Number 9, to provide for internal audits and to assist the Board of Regents in the appointment of its independent auditors. Regent Carter.
So we changed the policy a while back to where Joe Sunberry reports to the board, and so he's a direct board employee. I'm assuming that in that role he would be the person in charge of handling internal and external audits. So I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. So you think we can delete this?
The chancellor physically is not in control of our internal auditor.
So I'm hearing to delete this.
I agree. Andrew's not here. We might, if he would allow us to check independent auditors. I don't know who does the external audit, if that's Joe or if that comes through Andrew.
The external audit comes through the committee. We I'm not sure how the search happens in RFP, but it comes back through the audit committee.
Then I think we can get rid of this.
But you can definitely clarify that.
Okay.
The financial ones don't, do they? Patrick, don't those go through business and finance?
All the external audits come back through the audit committee.
Okay.
Okay. So as 9 is reading, to provide for internal audits, but that we can delete that. So item 9 is deleted. We're in consensus there, I see. Good. Number 10, to recommend appointment of special counsel. Maybe some background on this, Vice Chancellor Abba, please.
For the record, Crystal Abba, I actually don't know the history on this provision that's been there for some time, unless it is. Dale, I'm going to defer to you.
So Jimmy's going to bail me out here. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, I think this allows the chancellor to appoint counsel besides the general counsel who is staff. For example, we have real estate counsel. We might have Title IX counsel to deal with specific employment law. So this allows your chancellor to have outside legal services in addition to those in the counsel's office.
Jimmy Martinez, for the record, that's correct. There's certain instances, for instance, if the chief general counsel was conflicted out of a matter and special counsel had to be appointed, sometimes we go to the AG's office for something like that. But it is an important item to have the chancellor have the ability to do without waiting for a board meeting.
Okay. Regent Carter.
So this could be a silly question, but it's getting late in the day. To recommend appointment of special counsel, who is he recommending it to? Is he hiring?
I thought it was to the board.
If you're going to hire a real estate counsel, you don't come to the board, do you? Who is it recommending it to? Is he hiring or is he recommending it?
Maybe we need to clean this up a little bit, revise maybe.
maybe we'll check with, we'll let Jimmy have time, but it may be revised to say to appoint a special counsel. Maybe we could add collaborate in there, Byron.
I'm all for collaboration. Let's
have some consultation.
Yeah, sure.
So to stay on, Regent.
About this, there was reasons given why there would be a recommendation or appointment of special counsel. I think it needs to be a little bit more specific of why the special counsel, and then a report back to the board that, you know, we needed this person, this real estate person, because of these reasons, so that we're aware of it also at the board level.
So for the record, Taylor Kiaga, so remember, this is a job description. So let us look elsewhere at policy where there might be provisions needed to constrain the chancellor or make the chancellor explain that action. But I don't think I'd put in the job description to appoint special counsel in the circumstances of this or that. I think we'd govern that in another part of the document. But thank you. Thank you.
How are we doing, Vice Chancellor Abba? You got that one?
For the record, Crystal Abba, just to keep us all on the same page, you have agreed generally to revise this. I will have a discussion with Jimmy in terms of that language, most likely deleting the reference to recommend and something akin to the authority of the chancellor to appoint special counsel and establish a separate policy that defines that authority more specifically, but more importantly, includes a reporting provision back to the board.
That sounds good. Okay.
That was good.
What she said. Number 11, to be the appointing and evaluating authority of all professional personnel not assigned to a member institution. Regent Carter.
What does this mean?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Dale Urquiaga. What this says is that the chancellor appoints your the professional staff of the system office. It's just written like it's from the Middle Ages. I don't know why, but that's what it says.
So, Regent Brooks, for the record.
Well, you know,
Go
ahead and read Regent Carter.
Regent Carter.
So the way I read it, and maybe I get cut up by member institutions, so if you hired somebody at UNLV and accidentally didn't assign them to a supervisor, are you then their supervisor? I don't know. I just think it reads really weird.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I actually do know the history on this one. For the record, Crystal Abba, way back in the day, professional employees used to actually sign a contract every single year, and there was an appointing authority, and ultimately the chancellor signed off on every single one of those contracts for system admin and SCS only, which is why this says any unit that is not assigned to a member institution. So if it is a special unit that is part of an institution or it's the institution itself, the chancellor does not sign that. In addition, on every annual evaluation of the employee, there is a signature line for the employee, the supervisor, the vice chancellor, and the chancellor. So this, I mean, it's archaic, but it does clearly establish that as the head of the agency, he is the ultimate hiring and evaluating authority.
Regent Brooks.
Regent Brooks, thank you. Chair Regent Brooks, for the record, I was just going to offer that. Maybe we completely wordsmith this, and rather than using Shakespearean language, or let's just
give the staff direction to let's just fix that up how you want it and bring it back to us.
Yeah.
How's that? Be here. Number 12, to evaluate the annual performance of each president of the member institutions in accordance with procedures established by the Board of Regents. So, Vice Chancellor Abba, put this in context now. This is in the job description, but how is this going to...
Correct. So this, I mean, to some extent, this does align, because you'll notice this says the annual performance of each president. This does not get into the periodic evaluation.
Okay.
And with the revisions that you made in the prior section, that will be done in consultation with the chair and vice chair. So this language is accurate in terms of current procedure and procedure as you have revised it under the prior item. So I think you can retain this.
Okay. I agree with you, and I'm seeing some consensus here among board members, committee members nodding, so we can retain that one. Item 13, to participate in the periodic performance evaluation of each president in accordance with the procedures established by the Board of Regents.
As we will be bringing back two options for you, I think for now you can retain this because it uses that term participate.
I think that's the way we want to go here. Committee, strong work. We're coming near the end here. What do we got here? Number 14, to discipline presidents, bracket, procedural discipline procedures delineated.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Crystal Abba. So this item, when you currently look at this section of the handbook, you have all of these general items. This is just poor structure. So in addition to all the job description items, it then says to discipline the presidents, and then it tells you how to discipline the president. So that actual language on how to discipline the president doesn't get included in the employment contract. So I would highly recommend the fourth box to move the provisions so we put it into a separate subsection. So that falls in the bucket of a technical change. And then the next item is revise the procedures outlining the procedures for the discipline of the presidents to provide for the discipline of the chancellor. So again, you treat executives at this, those executives the same way. So I would recommend that as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Regent Carvalho. And I think we're seeing consensus on that to do both of those. Looks good. Number 15, other roles and responsibilities not currently denoted in Title I, Article 7, Section 3. So we have direction from the committee to be responsible for planning and processes related to academic programs, planning. I'll let you take this, Vice Chancellor Abbott.
Thank you for the record. I'll just walk you through all of these. So as we went through this and the chancellor and I worked on developing the document, we had a long conversation about what are the items that are critical to the system that the chancellor has, the chancellor or the system office and the chancellor as its head has a role in that are ostentatiously absent from the current job description. So that includes all things related to academic programs and student services. So essentially, we have a Department of Academic and Student Affairs in the system office that supports the ARSA committee. It is key to the function of the system. And so the first box is recommended to be responsible for research programming and activities. Obviously, we have the Desert Research Institute. Research is part of your strategic goals. This is always something that is core to your discussions and that the chancellor is often involved in the high-level oversight of. To be responsible for matters related to representing the system and its institutions during a legislative session, you do have that in the on the prior page. Two pages back, number 8, or whatever it was. So this one you may not need. I'm sorry, number 7. So I don't think you need that one, my apologies. And then the next one, to be responsible for matters related to community engagement, workforce development, economic development.
Okay, so box 1 and 1, 2, and 4, is that what I'm looking at? Regent Carter.
So EPSCoR and statewide grant opportunities, does that need to be more specific in here? Or can you, I don't know, I guess probably it needs to be in there.
EPSCoR and sponsored program functions.
State sponsored programs or grant, or I mean, you can craft it however.
Looks good. With that suggestion, I see consensus on that. Regent Geddes was there. That brings us to 16, other roles and responsibilities to be added, deleted, or revised to the handbook. If any of the committee members have a suggestion, Regent Carter.
So did we get to the system thing that Brooks was talking about, or do we need to talk more about that?
Mr. Chair, for the record, yes. Dale Arquiaga, I think we would add here to be responsible for system administration, business plan, and goals, language to that effect.
Regent Brooks, for the record, I thank you, Regent Carter, for bringing that up, and I agree with what the Chancellor just said. That is probably the perfect spot to add in different things. And I don't know if there's any other, if we're talking about revisions to the handbook, not recognizing the some of the duties, I guess, that we just went through were to ensure that those roles are clarified, right? The chancellor and the president, that the roles are there's no confusion in the language of what these positions look like. And my concern is that it's the same concern that all of us have on this board, is that there are some things that are written in such a way that it's ambiguous, confusing, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 on some of this. And so I guess if there's anything else that we have to put in here, that maybe there's some considerations of additional thought to be able to do that. And that's what I would offer.
And other duties as assigned?
Dale's not laughing.
Regent Carter.
Slightly off or slightly different to that, but so when we roll this stuff out, like, is this to the next chancellor's contract? Like, does any of this change on the president's contracts? How does this actually work, like, when this is approved?
For the record, Crystal Abbott, let me just explain the next step between now and December. So what we will do is the chancellor and I will go back, and with Jimmy, we will draft formal handbook revisions. So we will come back with the typical format that you're used to of bold italics for new language and bracket and strike through for deletions. And we will do that for everything in Title I, Article 7, Section 3, and then all the prior handbook revisions. So there's going to be several sections that will be included there. For the next chancellor's employment contract, that employment contract includes the provisions of Title I, Article 7, Section 3. So what you did in the last several pages will then be codified in that contract going forward. Now, what we haven't discussed, and that may be for another time, is there are other provisions within that contract that you can address at the time you hire the next chancellor that you may want to address at that time, which wasn't within the scope of this work. But that's generally how we will bring this forward in December.
Mr. Chair.
Regent Boylan, and then we'll chancellor.
Thank you. It's just a quick question. So does that mean this chancellor can do what he likes now? Because this is for the next chancellor. Yes, it's getting late. I was just trying to
lighten it up. I understand. Thanks. Chancellor.
For the record, Dale Urquiaga, I think that's very funny. So I was going to say two things. One, I don't think anything that I remember from today would change a presidential contract of any of the sitting presidents. I'll have to have general counsel review what their contracts say about the annual and periodics. I think it simply says that they are subject to an annual and a periodic pursuant to procedures established by the board. So if you change the underlying procedures, I think the contract stays, but I am not a lawyer. I only play one on TV, so we'll review their contracts. The same would hold for mine. Nothing that you've done here in any way makes my job any easier. I'm kidding. Changes the underlying contract for that I have. You've added, you've adjusted, but I don't think you need to amend that contract either. So I think we'll be okay from the contracting side.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can say we've done some work here and created more work for Vice Chancellor Abba and the Chancellor. And we'll go to item 5, new business. New business for this committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, this is Dale. I don't have another way to do this. I just want to thank Crystal for her work. This would not have happened if it wasn't for her arcane and complete knowledge of these processes and the handbook. And so she's the one that conceived of the discussion guide and this process for this meeting. So I just want to give her due.
Thank you, Crystal. Thank you.
What he said. No, I really appreciated the way the discussion was guided and the questions that were asked to make us actually think about what we really, really wanted, and I appreciate that.
Okay, we will go to public comment. Is there any public comment in Reno?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Kent Ervin, ERVIN. Thank you all for this long discussion. It's a lot of work, and thank you for that. I just want to bring up one point on the removal of the role of the chancellor to collaborate on the agenda. That's fine. It's a board responsibility. I get that. But it may have a consequence of, and this need to be checked in the rest of the handbook, of the ability for the chancellor, presidents, or the faculty senates to bring forward agenda items and not have them be able to be blocked by a single person. Some other mechanisms, because it used to be a collaboration, and now it's that's taken out. So I think those processes for bring for, you know, if an institution has a very important item that has come up through shared governance, that might be supported by the board but could be blocked by the chair. I think that's an issue, and there needs to be some mechanism to bring forward such agenda items. Thank you.
Any other public comment in Reno?
That's it for Reno.
Any public comment in Elko? Public comment in Las Vegas?
Yes, I'll only take a minute. Esteemed members and Chancellor and whatever two or three public people are still left listening, I am Tracy Sherman, the Faculty Senate Chair from CSN. I want to thank you for your thoughtful discussion today. I've held my comments to the end of the meeting so I can tailor my remarks. As you finish polishing your recommendations, I hope you will keep the following in mind. I echo the statements of my colleagues from the North who spoke during public comment earlier. The chancellor should be empowered with the authority to supervise our institutions. A system leader with firsthand knowledge of the work of faculty is extremely important also. Faculty on the ground generate weighted student credit hours. We are your bread and butter. We have spent much of the time today discussing presidential evaluations and discipline, and I would like to add a little to that topic of presidential disciplinary process. Currently, when there are immediate issues with the leadership at one of our institutions, there's no way to avert crisis. Without a clear and direct supervisor over presidents, it is a challenge for employees to attain redress. We are forced to sneak around and discuss things with people and make small talk. We have to drop hints, or we have to stand up publicly and risk retaliation by speaking publicly at one of your meetings to express our grievances to 14 different people. This is particularly true if there are small things the president does which need to be seen in totality to identify a pattern of a president's failure to perform duties. Under this system, how many problems are going unreported? Due to open meeting laws, it is impossible to deal with presidential issues in a private manner, as you have established today. If we could speak to the legislature, you would get a lot of support from at least faculty senates for that. Well, we're talking to everyone. Were you all talking to people while everybody's trying to like secretly have these little meetings all over the place? How much time goes by before everyone is informed? And on the ground, the issues are continuing. The chancellor's not been empowered enough to make executive intervention decisions. Problems fester, waiting for attention, and long-term damage is likely to result. The regents have every reason to ignore bad behavior until it is so egregious it is reported to the media, and this reflects badly on your reputation. The chancellor or another individual could be appointed or should be appointed with unmitigated, unquestionable authority to deal with immediate institutional discipline. Should a special meeting need to be called later, so be it. However, someone should have the power to swiftly intervene when a crisis is at hand. You've discussed the act of terminating a president, but can a chancellor suspend a president if he or she informs the board first? Must he call all 13 of you before the action? What if only one of you is available, or all but one of you is available? Does he have to have a quorum? Does he send an email, and then does he have to wait for everybody to get back? Does that violate open meeting laws? And all the while, the president is in the seat without any breaks on his behavior. When you're dealing with someone who has ultimate authority over hundreds or even thousands of your employees, how much retaliation must these workers endure before progressive discipline takes place? If the institution president is misbehaving in many different ways, how is this progressive discipline meted out? Must the president do the same thing over and over, or are these different items taken together to be stacked?
And Dr. Sherman, if you can conclude.
I hope that as you develop measurable goals, I encourage you to remember that happy employees are more productive, and the morale of faculty and staff does not readily lend itself to an objective matrix. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thanks, everyone.